Blog Talk Radio.
What's wrong with being an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times?
Do you want to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times?
Yeah, I think I'd like to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times. Then grab it! Grab it!
Mary had a little lamb and Jesus was his soul. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Yeah, I'm super cool. Oh!
I never once said, na-da-da.
I think everyone wants to know where we came from and how the universe began.
You know what I'm saying?
I have sinned against you.
Reese.
And welcome back, folks. It's Reese on the radio. We're back on the air. And those of you who tuned in yesterday, you know, we're at the end of the show after, what, an hour and a half? Due to technical difficulties on my side. And that's what happens when you're live. No things happen. What else are you going to do? You have to lace up your boots and get ready for another day. And that's what we do here. It's Teresa Radio. You know the number, 347-308-8701. And we thank you for tuning in every chance that you get for checking us out. And we try to give you, you know, the news, our views, and a lot of fun, too. Because it's usually just, you know, it's a laugh fest to hear on Reese on the Radio. Don't forget to log on to ReeseOnTheRadio.com. And any chance you get, got archives of the show. And send us an email at ReeseOnTheRadio@yahoo.com. Maybe why you bugging is in the house. Hello, Mary.
Good evening, Mr. Reese.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
You know, it's just one of those days. It's Therapy Thursday, as many of you know. Not that I'm going through anything personal, but you know, we always like to give you some sort of a personal aspect of our lives, or at least my life. That's the reason why we do it.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs. I'm a mercy. And maybe I seem a bit confused.
Always have to play the Frasier theme.
Ha!
I play the Frasier theme. I have to play the Frasier theme, just to let everybody know. Therapy Thursday.
They're calling again.
Are you not feeling too well? Your voice sounds a little...
Oh, you know what? I've got something going on with my throat, and you know, I don't even know exactly what it is. You can hear it in my voice, right? It sounds like hoarse or something. It's like there's a little scratchiness in it. Is that what's going on?
Yeah,
I know. Don't worry. I'll get that melodic voice that you all know and love. I'll have it back soon enough. Look, there are plenty of things in the news we have to cover, and we will. But I need to go back to a conversation we were having yesterday there that was in some... What are you, in traffic? What is that?
Yes. Sorry.
That's all right. You just sound like you're on a...
I am on 495 on the Beltway in Virginia trying to make it home.
Goodness gracious. But anyway, a discussion that we were having yesterday about Michelle Obama... and this angry black woman stereotype that she's been getting. I want to focus on that and sort of play you some audio. Mary, you have the window open. It sounds like a truck coming by you. Hold for a second. Hold on. I got to put her on hold. I need to play this audio on Michelle Obama and this whole, you know, people talking about her being an angry black woman. And look, I don't think she's an angry black woman. I just think she's an angry woman. I don't think that she's some different kind of angry as a woman. She's just an angry woman. And that's it. James Montgomery, of course, is the house. Hello, James.
Hello.
I'm glad you're back. As I was said just a moment ago, this whole angry black woman moniker that I talked about with Michelle Obama is now... You know, things are starting to really clear up in this whole conversation about her, about her problems with being in the White House. So let's start with what Michelle Obama said in an interview she did with Gayle King on CBS. And listen to what it is that she says about Jodi Kantor's book.
Now, it's my understanding that you have not read the book.
Yeah, I never read these books. There are so many books that have my picture on the cover, my name on it, and I don't even know what's going on. So I've just gotten into the habit of not reading other people's impressions of people. Right. You know, I guess it's more interesting to imagine this conflicted situation here and a strong woman and a, you know, but that's been an image that people have tried to paint of me since, you know, the day Barack announced that I'm some angry black woman.
Yeah.
So people are portraying her as an angry black woman. Well, Jodi Kantor, the writer of the book, addressed that exact sort of claim that Michelle Obama is being portrayed as an angry black woman. And I said yesterday that it was unwarranted. I said the press was using Jodi Kantor's book and was creating a false narrative. That in nowhere in the book, and I hadn't read it either, Michelle Obama, as you heard in the beginning of that piece, she says she's not read the book, but went on to say that she's being portrayed as an angry black woman. And Jodi Kantor responded on a Washington, D.C. radio show like this.
Well, I'm an angry black woman, thanks. You know, I have to think that she must have been responding to the coverage of the book, not the actual book. So one thing, she said she didn't actually read the book, so she doesn't really know what's in it. And then the second thing is that there's no statement in the book of her as an angry black woman. It's a, you know, the reviews have said this, it's a really textured, nuanced portrait of her as a, you know, well-rounded.
So there's nothing in Jodi Kantor's book that uses the term or references her as an angry black woman. So,
right. Now,
back to the argument. Why is Michelle Obama using the term angry black woman if she's, one, never read the book, and Jodi Kantor clearly says in the book there's no references to her. So where's the angry black woman coming from?
I got my hand up in case, you know, I know we're on the radio here. I got
one. Go ahead, Horshack.
frankly, even though she has said she has never read the book, all right, and as you said, Ms. Kantor never used it. The fact is, angry black woman was a term made by the media. It's been bandied about. It's been bandied about. It was manufactured. All right, again, manufactured. So now she says, okay, well, I don't like being portrayed as an angry black woman.
So she's responding to the press, correct?
She's responding to the hoopla.
No. The hoopla created by whom?
By the, who's ever reporting on the report.
Who's ever reporting on the book. In essence, you read Jodi Kantor's book, she says that Michelle Obama is angry or disenfranchised or upset or whatever it is, and the narrative, a false narrative, has been portrayed in the media that Michelle Obama is portrayed as an angry black woman.
It's a buzz term in the book.
Right?
In the book, but that's in what somebody else said. But that was that's the point I wanted to make. That's the point I wanted to make, because nowadays it isn't the accusation that's called into question. Oh no, I'm sorry. It's not the accuser that's called into question. All right. Nowadays, it's the accuser gets buried under the accusation.
Right. And that's my whole point. Is that, see, Michelle Obama, she never read the book, should not in any way whatsoever be using the moniker "angry black woman" in a book she's never read, and in a statement made by a media that read a book that didn't have the statement. So, in other words, here's Michelle Obama. She's perpetuating a narrative that does not exist. And she's allowed to say that she's being crazy. Today. Oh, she's not allowed. I'm glad you said that, Jay.
No, she's not.
Allowed. She's not allowed.
Not allowed. I'm not saying that I'm not allowed. What I'm saying is she didn't say that she was denigrating the book. She said herself she never read the book. What she was upset about was she was being betrayed as an angry black woman. She never said in the book. She said she never. It doesn't matter by who. It's just I don't want to be portrayed as an angry black woman, no matter who it is.
But wait a minute. How can you create a false narrative? See, I think that there are two people responsible here for creating a false narrative, and that is the media, Michelle Obama perpetuating it.
No, Michelle Obama is not perpetuating. How can you perpetuate something that you didn't create? No matter who perpetuated it, I'm not an angry black woman. It's everyone else who is saying, oh, well, now she's saying it against the writer of the book. No, she's not going against the proposed accuser.
Okay, can I cut in here for a second?
Yes, Mary, please.
Okay. So, Jamie, I understand, or Dave, I understand your point. First of all, she said that she never read the book. So how can she perpetuate something that she can't be referencing the book because she said she's never read it. All she did say was she doesn't want to be labeled as an angry black woman because that is something that the media has come up with. She's not saying that Jodi Kantor came up with it, but I don't know what clip you have from what radio station you have. I hope you have that from WNAL radio station this morning.
Yes, I do.
And if you do, I would like for you to play the beginning of Jodi Kantor's interview, because the beginning of her interview is very, very apparent that there are some, to me, that there are some major racial undertones, as you call them, in the beginning of what she says.
Well, tell me what he means.
The Obamas.
Well, okay. I know what you're talking about. I don't have that audio, but I will decipher what it is you're talking about, Mary. And that's what she said in that interview. She said something along the lines of that the Obamas were outsiders. Is that what it is you're talking about?
And they were out of their element.
Well, they were. They are political outsiders. Barack Obama had only been involved in Washington in 2004.
It wasn't what she said. It was not what she said. It was in the way that she presented it. The way that she presented it after all of this craziness that's going on in reference to her book and the angry black woman, the way that she referenced that, and the tone that she chose to take, and the emphasis that she put on what she said, seemed to be a little racially motivated.
Oh, there's no racial tinge in saying that the Obamas are outsiders to the White House. She even goes so far as to say, we know the Bushes, or George W. for that matter, were familiar with the White House because his dad was there. So they have some sort of lineage in the White House. The Obamas were political outsiders. And in her mentioning that, I don't think she's doing anything that's even racially undertoned. I don't think she's saying that. She's saying that, and not only that, Jodi Kantor goes on to say in her interview that she believed that Michelle Obama excelled in her role.
And she believes that she has excelled in her role because she has gone to something other than style, and there was something else that she said. She said when Michelle first came into the White House, she was, her thing was about style, and I forget what the other thing she mentioned and since then she has excelled and gotten into other things.
Well, she gives a very glowing story about Michelle Obama in this book. She says her interpretation of Michelle Obama in the book is the woman who was out of her element and rose to the occasion. She says it's a very adoring portrayal of Michelle Obama. But she's absolutely right when she says, I never referred to her as an angry black woman. Why is that not portrayed?
And I completely agree with you on that. She never did refer to her in the book as an angry black woman. And I don't know why the media is running around making the allegation that she was referred to as an angry black woman in the book, because it is a complete untruth. And if you read the book, you'll know that.
Right. And most of those people have not. What I'm telling you is, and I said this in day one, that the race war was coming, that the people who are political operatives for the Obamas are going to find every chance they got, every chance, to make this about race, and they did that, and they continue to do that. But I don't want to harp on that. There's also something else that I want to talk about, Jody Cantor's book, and that was, we played Soledad O'Brien's dismissal of Jody Cantor's book about Halloween parties, and I'll play what Soledad O'Brien said, and then Jody Cantor's response to what actually happened in that Halloween party.
It is time to get real this morning. There's a new book coming out this week. You probably read a little bit about it. It's written by New York Times reporter Jody Cantor and claims to reveal all the hidden secrets of the Obama administration, among them an Alice in Wonderland Tea Party-themed Halloween party back in 2009 that she claims the White House felt was so rife with Hollywood rife, I think that word is, rife with Hollywood glamour at a time when Americans were suffering, that the White House wanted to keep it a secret. This is what she's claiming in her book. It was designed by Tim Burton at the same time his movie, very over-the-top movie, was being released. It was attended by the Mad Hatter himself, Johnny Depp, and the original Chewbacca from Star Wars was sent by George Lucas to entertain the guests. Big over-the-top party. So according to this book, this is what Jody Cantor writes. Quote, White House officials are so nervous about how a splashy Hollywood-esque party would look to jobless Americans that the event was not discussed publicly, and Burton and Depp's contributions went unacknowledged. Well, not really. You take a look at, and it's not hard, with a Google search, you can find that CNN covered the party, NBC covered the party, Reuters covered the party, the Associated Press covered the party, USA Today covered the party, and the Chicago Sun-Times also covered the very, very top secret party. We asked the White House if they tried to keep it a secret. They said, well, not really. There's a video of the party on our official White House website. Take a look at that. Johnny Depp's fan site had a post about his appearance at the party. So for a secret keeping of this White House Halloween party with Hollywood celebs, not so secret. Maybe it wasn't a secret at all, Ms. Cantor. You might want to get real on that.
Now, Jody Cantor, again today on WMAL, responded to that allegation that the party was indeed public. But that turns out not to be true. I checked the White House website, and there's no Johnny Depp or Tim Burton there at all. But here's Jody Cantor's response to that.
So I think what's gotten confused, and again, this is clear in the text of the book, is that there were two elements of the Halloween celebration. There was the outside part, and that, of course, was completely visible. The Obamas are standing on the North Portico greeting trick-or-treaters,
right.
Washington kids. It was the party inside that was much more Hollywoodish. That's where Tim Burton was. That's where Tim Burton and Johnny Depp were. That's where Johnny Depp was in costume. That's the part that was not publicized.
That's the part that was not publicized. And if you go to any one of the websites, CNN, the Soledad O'Brien, angrily, and I think it was spiteful, said that it was covered. It was spiteful when she said it was a secret party. And she says, you know, it was lavish with Hollywood exclusive. She mentions Chewbacca and Johnny Depp like those two parties were indeed the same. But there's no evidence that press covered the Alice in Wonderland event. And it didn't become public. And that's the reason why there's an outrage or even a report. It's because everyone's going, no, we did cover that. No, it wasn't covered. No, there's no video of it. When the picture came out, the only reason why the picture came out was because of Jody Cantor's book. And Jody Cantor, what she did was expose a secret that the press is now forced to back themselves, you know, they back themselves into a corner. They're a little upset that not that they got scooped, but that Jodi Kantor is telling tales out of school. And you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to make us look like we didn't cover the Obamas. So now they're carrying water for the Obama administration, and they look like fools. They clearly look like fools. And trying to excoriate and try to vilify and try to demagogue Jodi Kantor, for a woman who covered the Obamas for 5 years, as she said in that interview, 5 years. And she dealt with everyone who was involved with them, spoke personally to 35 members of the White House staff, and did this book that now they feel as though someone is given inside that shouldn't have been given, that the Obamas in some way are portrayed in a poor manner, and that's the absolute antithesis of what the press is doing for the Obama administration. I think this is bias on their part, and I think Jodi Kantor, who's probably going to get a lot of hell and continue to get a lot of hell, why does this woman have to defend her book? And she even says in that interview that no one at the White House, by any means in that White House, has challenged her book at all. They've not challenged anything that she wrote. And that's the bottom line.
Now, Reese, you say that, you know, I mean, this has happened to other presidents as well. It's not like the Obamas are the only people that have ever covered anything up.
So what?
Well, first and foremost, can we not keep saying cover it up? No one is saying that there was a cover-up.
But they did, cover it up. James, they did cover it up. If they didn't cover it up, they would have had the media.
Whoa. Let each other speak. Hold on. Mary's right about one thing, okay? Is that the Obamas, according to Jodi Kantor's book, which has been proven to be the truth, and it has, it's been proven to be the truth. If Jodi Kantor says that the lavish Hollywood party was not covered by the press because the White House staff said that it might be looked upon by the American public as being too lavish when so many Americans are unemployed, that, my friend, is a cover-up of what? This is the most important part. Here's the most important part. It is a cover-up for this reason alone. President Obama went into the White House with one moniker, that this would be the most transparent White House in history. Why? It's so transparent. Why cover up something as simple as a Hollywood party that it was Alice in Wonderland themed, that no press was allowed in? This is, the press should have been allowed, and it was. The press didn't cover it, which they didn't. And if it was the most transparent White House, and this woman told this party, the only reason why there's a story is because everyone turned around and said, really, this party happened? We didn't hear about this. Because we were there in 2009 for the Halloween. We saw Chewbacca.
Wait, Jamie,
let me finish. We saw Chewbacca. We saw Darth Vader. We saw.
That's right.
We saw President Obama come out and give kids candy. We saw all of that. But Johnny Depp and Tim Burton, we didn't see them. The Halloween, the Alice in Wonderland theme portion and the insider party, we didn't see that. We never saw any pictures. Johnny Depp was dressed as the Mad Hatter, and we don't have pictures of that. That means we didn't cover it. And Jodi Kantor writes this book, and everyone is completely flummoxed going, that happened? Because they all check the records, and they go, wait a minute, I was there. I didn't see any of this. And they're going, then they go to Jodi, and they go, did Jodi make this up? And then they find out, oh, it did happen. And the White House did cover it up. And then the question is arises.
How are you going to say they covered it up? How are you going to say they covered it up?
James.
When you reported the story from day one, you said yourself, and the lead seems to get buried again, all right, that the private party, they didn't want it said or noticed in the press. So it's not that you covered it up. How are they going to cover it up when they tell the press there's going to be a party?
They didn't tell the press that there was an outside.
Yes, they did. You just said it.
No, I didn't.
You said they asked the media not to report on it because it would look a certain way.
That's not what I said.
So
if they did that, then they said it about it, right? No, James, I said the White House staff said do not report this portion of the party to the press because if the press covers it, it might be looked upon in a bad way.
Again, what I'm saying is if it was a cover-up, why are they going to ask you to do so? That's not a cover-up. They're saying it's a cover-up. They tried to keep the press out of it as well.
But they told them about it.
No, James.
It turns out the press was not told about that portion of the party. They put the first party out as a front.
When they say that they were told...
No, they said they were told. No, the press. The press is actually now, they're all come clean. They all come clean. Go ahead, Mary.
Okay, can I jump in just to maybe kind of clarify something with James? No, what happened, James, was the press was told about the first party, the party that was outside that everybody saw. The press did cover that.
In return, the White House staff
decided not to tell the press about the inside party or second party because they did not want the coverage because it would have been, it may have been looked upon as a not so good thing to be doing when the country was in an economic depression, for lack of better words.
Economic downturn.
So that is what happened. It's not that the press was told, okay, hey, we're having this party.
Don't tell anybody.
That's not what happened. The press was never even told, but the press was told about the first party, about the beginning.
That's not the way you presented it. Well, that's not the way he just presented it.
That's why I wanted to jump in and explain.
Well, that's what I'm saying, Jamie. If I didn't send it that way, my apologies, but I'm trying to express
And again,
you.
now you're perpetuating a story of manufacturing a story.
And now the perception,
well, either way, the perception is taking on more of a force than the actual truth. Here's the truth, okay? If this was somebody named Trump or anyone else, they have a private party. You're rich. You can have somebody. Let's say I'm willing to give the Obamas the benefit of the doubt. Let's say one of their daughters is in love with that movie. Well, look, I'm one of the most influential men on the planet. I can actually make a party for my daughter or whoever, all right, and have the actual actors and the director there.
James, if you could see my face right now, you would see this look of, what the hell? Wait, James.
Hold on, I'm not done yet. Because I know what you're going to say.
What am I going to say?
You're saying, well, it was a cover-up, or the cover-up happened because they felt that a lavish party was going to be looked at unfavorably. But they were having a lavish party anyway. Chewbacca showed up.
James?
That was covered.
James, you failed in clairvoyance 101, because that wasn't what I was going to say. What I was going to say was this. You just said if Trump or any other rich person had done for their daughter, blah, 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 blah.
It wouldn't have been so much of a big deal.
Hold on. If you are trying to equate some rich private citizen with the president of the United States, that you made your first mistake. Let me finish.
I'm not trying to equate that.
What I'm saying is... You made the analogy, not me, so let me...
Yes.
You made the analogy. Okay. So let me address your analogy. You used Trump. You used any rich person. I did not. What you failed to realize is that everything the Obamas do in the White House is what the Obamas do in the people's house. That is the people's house. So everything that happens
the
there...
People's
house. Oh, wait,
and
wait.
No one else has ever had a party in the White
James,
House. Is that the case?
Not the argument. You can go all day and talk about...
It is the argument, because why is it such a big deal when the Obamas do it?
James, because there are two factors that play a key role in what I'm telling you. That is one, the Obamas are in the White House. That's one. The
so
second,
was Reagan.
Oh, James, not was. I said
so
in.
Was Bush.
James.
And there have been people who've been, I mean, come on, wait a minute. The Lincoln bedroom came out, and that was a big thing, all right? It's happened before. Why is it such a big deal when the Obamas do it?
James, I'm going to ask you, seriously, I need you to listen, because you refuse that. All I want you to do is pay attention to what I'm trying to explain to you. One, it is a childlike response to say to me, okay, as a grown man, he did it. He may have done it too. Not may. You have no proof that that happened in any other White House.
You're what do you
no
mean you proof. Don't have proof?
James,
it's been reported on.
James,
there, what do you mean there's
James,
no proof?
James, until you provide that truth, you cannot use it as an excuse.
The truth has already
James,
been provided.
James,
it's just
James,
everyone seems to overlook it now.
James, you want listen? Seriously, let's have a dialogue here. I want you to hear
okay.
what. Saying
yes,
you.
I want to have a dialogue, but
okay,
you
so
know, let's, you,
no, no, all you're doing is shouting over me every time you don't agree with something, and I need you to. If I let you finish, then give me the same courtesy. The courtesy
you're
I'm
right.
telling you is that, James, President Obama is in the White House today. It's never ever an excuse for a current president to use past experiences for him or as an excuse. Whoa, James.
Go ahead.
It's never the excuse of somebody currently in the White House or currently in a position to use someone has done it in the past as an excuse for him to get away for it with it today. Remember, if it's wrong before, it's wrong today, right? If it's wrong yesterday, it's still wrong today.
Who said it was wrong?
James?
Who said it was wrong?
The only thing I'm trying to express to you is this, okay? Is that what they did was wrong. Anybody does it. And if you have a concrete evidence that Bush did it, that Clinton did it, that Herbert Walker Bush did it, that Reagan did it, present that in your case. You can't do that.
I did. And that's
no, you gave nothing.
Okay,
the Lincoln
bedroom.
James, again, I'm going to say it to you again. Unless you tell me.
I'm not pulling that out of my butt. It's been reported on, has it not?
No, no, no.
And that wasn't Obama, was it?
Give me the story about the Lincoln bedroom at another time, but listen to what I'm talking about.
At another time?
Yes,
now you say, first you said,
Now I give you one,
and you say, give it to you another time.
Okay, you know what?
No, let me jump in here for a moment. James. Let me jump in. You got two completely different arguments going on right here.
Okay.
The argument that you're trying to make, James, is that if other presidents have had these type of parties, why is it a problem now that Obama's had one? That's your argument. That's not the argument. The argument is there were two parties. One was reported on, and the other one, which happened to be a little more lavish with the celebrities in it, wasn't reported on because it would have seemed insensitive at a time of economic turmoil in the country.
Okay. Right.
That's the argument that you're missing.
But if that was the case, then why have a party in the first place? I mean, because they did have a lavish party.
Well, no. Well, he's regardless, he's the president. He's entitled to it. They've all had the party.
Right.
That's right.
The problem is.
So wait,
the problem
if
is.
Saw nothing wrong with it. If he saw nothing wrong with it. If you don't see anything wrong with it, James, you're making a horrible argument for one thing, and that is this. You said, and I quote, what's so wrong with him having this lavish party? And my rebuttal to that argument is this. Somebody thought it was wrong, James, because they didn't report. They did not let the press in. So the Obamas and the Obama staff did enough to keep out of the press that even they thought it was wrong. You may not find something wrong with it, but they did. And I always say, if there's nothing to lie about, why lie?
And lastly, can I say something real quick, and I'll go back on the side.
Go ahead.
And if there hadn't been such a cover-up, it wouldn't be an issue now.
There you go. You know, James.
Wrong. Because there was going to be an issue anyway. There was
no, no. And then there should have been an issue in 2009 when it happened.
That's right. It should have been an issue then. You shouldn't be fighting out about it in 2012.
Yeah, if it happened in 2009 and there was a problem.
Yeah, it is now 2012. So people are now making an issue of it when it wasn't an issue then.
Again, James, you're fighting a different fight.
Yeah, we're still talking about it.
You're fighting a different fight, and you're not wrong. You're not wrong about it.
Go ahead, Harry.
Okay. James?
Yeah?
Okay, if they wanted to have the party, that's fine that they had the party. The issue that we are arguing here, or the issue that we're discussing here, is that it was a cover-up. Soledad O'Brien is saying there was no cover-up. There was no cover-up. First of all, she needs to do her homework because obviously there was a cover-up because no one knew about it. It's can I finish? Can you let me finish? These are the facts. I mean, these are facts. I do not agree with Reese, and we all know that, but these are the facts. The facts are that 3 years ago when the country was in an economic downturn, they chose to have a lavish party, which is on them. If they can afford to do it, then so be it. No one's arguing that. But the point is that there was a cover-up because it was specifically told not to let the press know because they knew that the country would not look at that in a favorable way. The Obamas chose to do that. They knew that they were going to be looked at in an unfavorable way. So they chose to hide it from everyone else.
I look at that with a red flag myself, because if that was the case, then the official cover party shouldn't have happened either. There's a whole bunch there. That doesn't make sense, and it doesn't add up. Now, if someone on the staff said that, and yet, you know, still looking at the one party and still said, well, the other party is not going to be favored on, then you shouldn't have had the others, okay? But that was someone on the staff.
But, James,
saying is it's all coming down on Barack and Michelle Obama. And more often than not, I'm sure they weren't even thinking about that. It's someone on the staff. Let's not say it's the Obamas.
Oh, I get
and
it.
Let's not say that there was a cover-up.
As the host, I'm going to ask you guys to give me 1 second. Jamie, if I can address you one way, but please just listen to me. I finally get where James is coming from. Do you know where James is coming from? He's coming from here. James is upset, or his argument lies with the blame that goes on Michelle and Barack. He believes personally they are not solely responsible, that there are staff members and people behind the scenes, the wheel spinners, who made this decision and fall on the responsibility Michelle and Barack Obama unfairly. Is that quite what you're getting at, James?
Yes, I can accept that, yes.
Okay, let me say this, my friend. Let me say this. The President of the United States is the CEO of the country. Everything falls on the head of a man in charge. Even if it's
really?
Staff. Yes, it does. Even if it's staff. Remember, if his staff is running roughshod over the President of the United States, now I want you to hear that. If the staff is running roughshod of the man in charge, then he's not fit to serve.
I'm so glad you said that.
He's fit to serve. If his staff can tell him that we're not going to publicize this party, Mr. President, because it'll look bad on you, and President Obama didn't take the directive, say, no, that's it's not a big deal. If he made the decision to go along with
that's
what
not
said,
what I said. That's not
no,
what
I'm
I said.
Saying,
but
I didn't say what you said. What? I'm saying it.
Go ahead. No, because I'm going to deal with what you said, too. And I'm so glad you said that. I want you to remember
decision,
you said that. Go ahead, finish your statement.
Final decision goes to the president. They go president and go, Mr. President, I know you want to throw this party, and it's all great and it's all good, but I think that it would probably look bad on to the country. We throw this party. Let's keep it out of the public eye. And President Obama says, yes, I agree. Then he is the one who has final say that this didn't get publicized.
Okay.
It goes through the head. Remember, the head
okay.
of the snake controls.
All right, and I agree with that. I agree with that, but I'm so glad. Are you done yet?
Go on.
Are you done yet?
Go on.
Because I don't want to be accused of talking over you again. Because I'm so glad you said that. Because we went to war for less.
James,
we went to war for less.
James, what, again, what?
Your personal favorite President Bush sent us to war thinking because his staff told him there were weapons of mass destruction hanging over our heads like the sword of Damocles.
Oh,
years
God.
Later, there
wait,
weapons of mass destruction.
Wait, nothing.
And he's the one who said, well,
I didn't. He was grasping at straws.
Wait. Hold on. James, I just put you on pause because I want you to hear something now that you're on pause. I'm glad that you brought up. See, I didn't want you to do this. You did it to yourself, my man. You did it to yourself. You did it to yourself. Now, keep him on pause, JC. Don't let him move. You keep him there. If he hangs up, call him back and put him on hold to make sure he's listening. If he doesn't pick up the phone, I want somebody to send a police officer to his house with a tape recorder and make sure that he listens to this. I want him to listen to this 100%. In 1998, in front of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, 1998, President William Jefferson Clinton and Al Gore spoke at the Pentagon in 1998. George Bush became president of the United States in 2000, November of 2000. So we're talking close to 3 years before George W. Bush becomes president of the United States, that Mr. William Jefferson Clinton, speaking at the Pentagon, says we must stop Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction program. So when you start blaming George W. Bush for WMDs, my man, that's where you got it wrong. And if you don't believe me, just tie your computer over to YouTube and put Bill Clinton, weapons of mass destruction, and you can see the video for yourself. So don't start talking about George W. Bush. You're wrong there. You're way off base. Okay? You don't want to take responsibility for your president saying, hey, listen, it's just a Halloween party. Don't get so mad. Now put him back on. It's all right. You put him back on.
No. Well, he doesn't. I fully understand his argument. The thing is, he's fighting the wrong fight.
He's fighting the wrong fight. He's totally fighting the wrong. He's a loose cannon right now.
James.
Yeah.
Bud. James.
Do I have to find the video? Do I have to find the audio for you where Bill Clinton says Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction?
I never said whether it was Bill Clinton or anyone else. All I said is we've gone to war for
James,
less.
James, one quick question for you. Did you hear about the second party up until now?
Up until now? No.
And you're an Obama follower?
I'm an Obama follower, yes.
And you didn't hear
you know
about
what?
This party
the
up until
is,
now?
It really doesn't matter whether they're in the White House or not. The Obamas are still, whether it's the Obamas, the Bushes, even if it was Bush, I still say that they have a right. Even though they're in the most public house in the world, it is still their house. For the 4 years or 8 years, it is still their house. They should be able to throw a party if they want.
Okay, can I jump in here? Can I jump in here real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, no one is arguing the fact that they did not have the right to throw the party. That's
exactly.
Not the argument.
Exactly.
That is not
the
argument. The argument
is throwing the party was wrong.
No one said that the party was wrong. The party was wrong. The party was not wrong. Having the party, whatever your opinion is on that, that's your opinion. No one is arguing that point, though, James. You're not. I understand where you're coming from a little bit, but the point is not that it was wrong or right that he had the party. Or the point we're making is that there was a cover up. Excuse me. And the media is saying that there was no cover up.
Right. He's missing the point, man. You're right. You're absolutely right. He refuses to deal with the fact that this was covered up. A cover up, you know, this isn't Watergate, but there was a cover up.
And I'm an Obama. I voted for Obama. I was an Obama fan. Excuse me, I'm sorry, Reese. Maybe you gave me the scratchy voice. So I'm not bashing Obama. I'm not bashing his wife. I'm not bashing the White House. But the facts remain that the party was covered up.
The news
is saying, the media is saying that it was not, which in fact is a blatant untruth.
There it is. And again, let's put Jamie on. Jamie, can you at least consider what Mary just said? Can you at least consider what he just said? It's not about the Obamas. It's not about whether or not they allowed a party. It's about what the facts are. Was the party covered up?
Okay.
Yes, we know that to be a solid fact. That's all we
have. Wait a minute. Now, and again, every time I try to say something, all right, I take offense to the words, not the context. Yes, was it told to be a private party? Did they try to keep it out of the media? Yeah, but when you say cover up, the negative connotations attached to it.
Oh, you okay.
give. Let me finish. It gives the situation more credence and more power than it had in the first place.
You know, I one thing I'm going to say, out of all the days that we've done this, this has obviously incited such a conversation. We were supposed to take a break 17 minutes ago, and we literally just went straight through 40 minutes, 45 minutes of dialogue about this. So I'm glad that this is it sort of incited such a passion. But I want you to do, go ahead, JC, what were you going to say?
Well, all of this over a converted party for a good time that was had by all.
Right. A good time was had by all. It shouldn't have been, I mean, even though, I can be accused of doing it too, and I'll take that. Because, again, it was manufactured by someone else. And that's the point I made earlier. The accuser is now buried. It's the accusation. And now we're all going after each other, and the person who made it up in the first place
made
is sitting back and laughing at us all.
Who made it
what?
Up? Whoa, 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 whoa.
Who knows? Dang. Nobody's Dang. Even asking the question anymore.
Dang. Who made the story up? The problem was that here's Jodi Picoult writing this book, right? It's the Obamas. So she's doing press coverage on a book. People read the book. They see this story about a Halloween party with Johnny Depp was there,
mm-hmm.
one of the biggest stars in Hollywood, Tim Burton,
mm-hmm.
probably one of the biggest names in movie making, and we didn't know this party happened, so people went,
and we didn't
why?
Know. Why should you
hold on,
have
hold on.
To know?
But wait a minute. They
but why
read
should
it.
You have to know?
But wait a minute. This is what incited that. In Jodi Kantor's book, she says that the White House staff thought that people would look at this party as too lavish and it might look unfavorable to the Obamas. So everyone turns around and responds to that. Wait. They respond to that claim
right.
by saying, you know
True.
What? Do you know what? She might be right because there was no press coverage of this party. And the fact that she has been writing a book saying that it was hidden from the press. And so the press is saying to themselves, something was hidden from us from the White House, and then they make a decision. Which side of this story are we going to be on? Are we going to be on the side that says, hey, Obamas, you didn't invite us to the party?
They got
or they're going to go on the other side where they go, Jodi, what are you trying to say? Are you trying to say the Obamas hid stuff from us? We don't like that. And they attack her.
Right.
And what they choose to do, instead of going to President Obama and his staff and going, hey, did you cover up this party or did you keep it a secret? Instead, they said, no, let's attack the author.
Right.
And they
right.
And what,
true. And
what
that was wrong.
Think,
that was wrong,
think,
too. I don't disagree with that.
Okay. So here's where the discussion lies, James. The discussion lies is that the press decided, and you know they did, the press
yep.
decided attack Jody Kant.
Right. And since
wait,
the press
wait, wait, wait.
Decided
what
to do it,
been,
everyone
what,
else decided to jump on the bandwagon.
Wait. What would have been
what?
The prudent thing? What would have been the prudent thing for the press to do in learning about this party? What would have been the prudent thing? That's my question. They hear this story
well,
about a party that wasn't covered by the press, that they were kept secret from, and I asked you, and I'm not using cover-up, they were kept secret from, what should the prudent, what was the prudent thing that the press should have done in finding out this information through her book? What should they have done?
All right, what should they have done and said, oh, well, you know what? Well, frankly, and been like, okay, well, good on you. You were there, all right? You were there. You got it before we did, or, you know, whatever. But, and then just move on. What they did was, oh, in the public eye, you told the public that you knew something we didn't. We're the press. How dare you? So what did they do? They went after her.
All I'm asking you is, Jamie, you're saying that the press should have read the book, heard story and gone on about their business. They shouldn't have said anything. Even though they find out.
Well, frankly, it was already over.
Right. No
when
story.
When the book came out, it was already 3 years old. There was nothing you could have done.
That's what
okay.
I'm saying.
Can,
go
okay,
on.
Hold on.
But that's not what happened.
Hold on. Mary, go ahead, and then JC.
So what I think should have happened was, instead of the press attacking Jody Kantor, they should have gotten their facts first, found out that this party did happen and that there was no coverage, and not got on live national television and continue to attack this woman and accusing her of lying. And,
right.
and so then O'Brien says, oh, she needs to get her facts straight. No, you
ding,
need
ding,
to get
ding,
your
ding.
Facts straight.
Whoa, James. Now, before
he
says... Before JC says something, Mary, this is first. With the exception of me, you get the first round of applause.
Yep.
That was eloquently put.
Somebody better call 911.
That was eloquently put. So, James, based on, and you addressed that. JC, what was your point? Go ahead.
I was with a brother and a sister in the White House. Not everybody can go to the after party anyways.
There it is. So what, he had an after party. Oops. If it was Jay-Z or Donald
Stop
Trump
comparing.
Or anyone
Stop
else, it wouldn't
comparing.
Have been such a big deal.
James, stop
oh my God.
Stop comparing Jay-Z to the President of the United States. Stop comparing Donald Trump
he's the President of the United States or not, it doesn't make them any less a human being.
He's on a timeout for a quick second. No, Mary, let me address Jamie so you can hear this, okay? Jamie does not understand the role of the President of the United States. And he's going to be mad because he's shouting into the phone right now. Shouting into the phone when I'm saying this. Jamie does not understand the role of the President of the United States. He is a man. He is no longer a private citizen. He is a man. He has the right to certain freedoms. But unfortunately, as the President of the United States, you are the people's president. And everything you do falls under a certain scrutiny. Everything it is that you do falls under a certain scrutiny. Jamie is of the ilk, and I want you to hear this, James. James is of the ilk that looked at President Clinton when his Monica Lewinsky scandal happened and said, so what? It didn't matter that he was having this sexual liaison with a 21 or 20-year-old girl in the Oval Office in the People's House. He is of the ilk that says, so what? That is what it is that I'm talking about. That you defile the office of the President of the United States for your own personal gain, and he thinks that's acceptable because he's a man, and sometimes a man needs his, you know, his thing, whatever it is. And he is forgetting that that role, and this is a problem in the United States today, it's a problem in the United States today, is that they have so desecrated the office of the President of the United States, they've so desecrated it, that is not even a pinnacle, and doesn't even stay on the pedestal that it belongs. How important, how relevant, how the stature of that leadership, of that position, needs to be revered and must be protected and treated such. It is the highest office of the land, and it must be dealt with respect. And if you violate it, you should be and will be scrutinized. I don't give a damn who you are, conservative or liberal. I don't care whether or not you're Bill Clinton or George W. Bush. When you defile that office, when you defile it, you must be held accountable. That is what it is that's become the state of the country we live in today, is that we don't even realize how important or how relevant it is to be the President of the United States and to make sure that you maintain the dignity of that office. That's it. Bottom line.
Amen.
And I know that sucks. It sucks, but it's true.
But it comes with the job. And if you want the job, then you have to pay the price for having that job. There are ups and there are downs. And that's the way it is.
It is the scrutiny of the job. It always will be. It always shall be. It bugs me that people don't get that. Anyway, we'll get back into some more stories when we come back. All right, I'm taking our first break, and then we'll do the top of the hour. We got plenty more stuff. Greece is – people in Greece, the parents putting their kids out to pasture because they can't afford them.
In Olympics hit by scandal and deficits, he rescued them. He turned around dozens of companies and became a business legend. A state losing jobs with huge deficits. Governor Mitt Romney turned it around, cutting spending instead of raising taxes. At every step, he's met extraordinary challenges. Mitt Romney, the energy and experience to turn around Washington.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Bleu.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
And I promise you, none of these people listen to my show. But here's some people who do.
Hey, Reese.
Hi, how you doing?
I don't think you're a buffoon.
Thank you, dear. George, you're on with Reese.
Hi there, Reese.
Hello, George.
Please let me do the talking today.
George, you're going to be brief.
I respect what you said because you know something, you're being honest.
Hey, I'm glad that you're bringing up what's most important, and that is the issues and where people stand and what they have for experience.
It's Reese on the Radio, weekdays at 7 p.m. right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Simple question. Which candidate gives us the best chance of defeating Barack Obama? The answer? Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is a full-spectrum conservative. Rock solid on value issues like life, marriage, and the right to own a gun, Santorum is also a favorite of the Tea Party for his efforts fighting corruption and taxpayer abuse in Washington. And Rick Santorum led the fight to overhaul welfare, ending abuse and helping millions go from welfare to work. But that's just the start. Rick Santorum has more foreign policy credentials than any of the candidates. And Rick Santorum's Made in the USA jobs plan will make America an economic superpower again. Rick Santorum, a trusted conservative who not only shares our values, but also gives us the best chance to take back America. Finally, a candidate we can all unite behind. Paid for by Rick Santorum for president.
This is Rick Santorum, candidate for president, and I approve this message.
There's Dr. Oz, there's Dr. Phil, there's Dr. Drew, there's Dr. Joy Brown. It seems like everybody's got an opinion, but I'm going to leave it to the real professionals. Call up at 347-308-8701 to give me your take. It's my problem, you deal with it. Right here on Therapy Thursdays on Reason Radio on blogtalkradio.com, 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights. on blogtalkradio.com.
Proven conservative leadership. Newt Gingrich. In uncertain times, we need a leader whose commitment to conservative values has been tested. Newt stood with Ronald Reagan. Newt stood up to Bill Clinton. And Newt was there for conservative values. But most importantly, Newt has always believed in the greatness of America, that America's best days are ahead. The choice. Newt Gingrich, the proven conservative leader. Winning our future.
What's wrong with being an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times? Do you want to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times?
Yeah, I think I'd like to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times.
Then grab it! Grab it!
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Yeah, I'm super cool.
I never once said na-da-da.
I think everyone wants to know where we came from and how the universe began.
You know what I'm saying?
I have sinned against you.
Welcome back, folks. It's Reese on the radio, and we're live. We went, and I've never ever done this before. I don't know one time in my career when I went one solid hour, first hour of the show, we didn't take one commercial break because a story was so vital. It was just one of those things that, I guess it sort of just gets people into these moods where, you know, they have to react to it, a story like this. And when you have somebody who's an ardent supporter of the Obamas, as, you know, James Montgomery is, Kool-Aid Man, and, you know, he loves, I don't know why, but I couldn't think of one thing that would... I couldn't think of one thing personally, and that's because me, I'm partial. James, like, you know, he's...
Oh, yeah!
He's, you know, he's Kool-Aid Man. He's drinking Kool-Aid, like something.
Oh, yeah!
Oh, yeah! He's drinking that Kool-Aid. And the guys are all on, are they here? I mean... Guys, I know...
It's been reported on.
Are you there, guys? But we're back up on the air.
Okay.
I know. I was just more or less expressing to earlier that James was, you know, so he's personally invested in the Obamas. And I'm going to take an opportunity soon to ask him to break down what it is about him, about Obama. Maybe we'll do it in the next break. And we'll take an opportunity for Jamie. We'll give Jamie 10 minutes. I'll break him down and say, James, tell me what it is about Barack Obama that you respect and love and appreciate. And I think we should do that just so, you know, it, to get an understanding why he supports them in such a way. James, we're not going to get back into them yet because there's another story that I know that you have an opinion. Okay, so this is an important story. I know tease that we're going to talk about Greece. We're going to talk about that a little later. Grecians, the people in Greece are so poor. There's so many families out there that are poor that hundreds of parents are leaving their children at, you know, adoption agencies and children's centers or whatever, dropping them off. One woman so far has to leave a kid, her daughter, with a note that said, you know, she couldn't afford to feed her anymore, so she had to let her go. They're dumping kids in the street. That's how crazy it is, a thing that's going on there. But this story kind of struck because it's about somebody who's, I would consider, relevant in my life personally, because he is one of the most successful directors in Hollywood. and he is the creator of Star Wars. His name is, of course, Mr. George Lucas. And, you know, my favorite movie of all time, and I've seen thousands, close to maybe even hundreds of thousands of movies, and I'm a movie fan. But The Empire Strikes Back is my favorite film of all time. It beats anything. Citizen Kane is in my top five, and it is one of the greatest films ever. But I have my personal reason about The Empire Strikes Back, because it has to do with a lot of things about the duality of man and, you know, the finance, the father and son, and it's something that is personal. George Lucas, I have a lot of respect for. Politically, he and I don't always agree. But let me ask you a question, James and Mary. Can we collectively agree that Hollywood is a liberal sort of it's a liberal society? Hollywood or Hollywood movies, it's pretty much liberally run. Can we agree there?
I agree.
Look at most actors and actresses, those who are in the mainstay of the Hollywood elite, they're usually liberals. And they are. If you look at the Hollywood elites, you look at all the actors and all the actresses, they all support liberals. They supported Bill Clinton just like they support Barack Obama.
Not all.
Well, no. There's only very, very few. If you look at the numbers of conservative celebrities, they are few and far between. You know, in the contrast of who are liberal supporters, you got Tom Hanks, Brad Pitt, and Angelina Jolie, who just at the White House. You look at Harvey Weinstein, who owns Miramax. You look at all of these people who are in the Hollywood mainstream, and they love and support liberals. They always have, and most people call it liberal Hollywood. They call it they are called the liberal elite.
Yeah, but who's the highest paid actor in Hollywood today?
Right now? It's not a conservative.
Yeah, well, yes it is.
Whom?
Well, who is it?
All right. Mission Impossible.
Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise,
not the highest paid, and he's a liberal. Look it up. He's a liberal. He's a psychologist, but he's a liberal.
Yep.
Will Smith, liberal. Makes $20 million a film. Liberal. You want Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, both liberal. John Voight, her father,
okay,
a conservative. Look at, who's his other list? George Clooney, liberal.
True.
Julia Roberts, liberal. Kevin Spacey, liberal. You look at all the way down the line. Steven Spielberg, Sean Penn, all liberals. You know, some of the biggest names in Hollywood, they're all liberals. Now, that being said, liberal agenda is what? Liberal agenda, if you ask any liberal, they'll tell you this, that liberals are about the people, right? They're about the downtrodden. They're about the people who need the most help, especially minorities, right? That's what liberal agenda is.
A minority in and of itself will need the most help. That's why they're a minority.
Exactly. So that's what liberals do. Liberals, they fight the cause of those who need the most help. Any liberal will tell you that. If you ask anybody what's the difference between a Republican and a liberal, they say liberals are for the people and Republicans are for the rich.
It's not even the liberals. Well, okay.
Well, no. James, we're not having a discussion about it. But if you ask
me, let's give the titles what they do, all right? It's not liberals and Republicans, because there are liberal Republicans. There are conservative Democrats. This has nothing to do with Republican and Democrat. There is liberal and conservative. Let's keep it at that. Hello?
I'm listening. There are liberals and Democrats. Go on.
All right. There are liberals. And then there are conservatives. There are Republicans. And then there are Democrats. There are liberal Republicans. There are conservative Democrats.
Social Republicans. No. Listen. They're called social conservatives. Social conservatives consider people. I want you to hear this. If I just told you that, I mean, we can all agree that Hollywood is known to have a liberal stance, right?
Right. Okay.
Okay. So I want you to hear this and why this is so relevant. Okay. This is a discussion by George Lucas with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. And I want to get your response to it when you hear it. Because if you think that Hollywood isn't racist, even though they're ardent liberal, this will definitely change your mind.
Who's the liberal?
Very patriotic.
Listen.
Very jingoistic.
Mm-hmm.
Very old-fashioned, corny. It's just exactly like Flying Leathernecks, only this one was held up for release from 1942 when it was shot. And I've been trying to get it released ever since.
You haven't been able to get it made, you know?
Well, no.
Maybe when you get some sway in Hollywood, you'll get a chance to put something to
that. Yeah. Well, that's what people say, you know?
How long have you been working on this?
23 years. 23 years. We finished it. I financed it myself, and I figured I could, you know, get the prints and ads paid for by the studios and that they would release it. And
right.
I showed it to all of them, and they said, no. We don't know how to market a movie like this.
Why?
It's not green enough.
Really?
They only release green movies.
I didn't realize that. So the message, because the message is patriotic and jingoistic and doesn't have any recycling in it, that's the problem?
No, it's because it's an all-black movie. There's no major white roles in it at all. It's one of the first all-black action pictures ever made.
Is that true?
Yeah.
The pedigree of it? They didn't want to take a chance on it?
Yeah. It's a reasonably expensive movie.
Right.
Normally black movies, say Tyler Perry movies or something, they're very low budget, and even they won't even release his movies. You know, it goes to one of the lower, not major distributors, and they do well, but they do a certain amount of money, and they know what that is, and this is cost more than what those movies make, so they figure, well, and they don't believe there's any foreign market for it, so, you know, that's 60% of their...
Wow.
Listen to this, and I want so I can set it up. So George Lucas is talking about his new film called Red Tails, and his new film, he financed it himself. It took him 23 years to finally get it completed. He said when he began putting the film together 23 years ago, he had 77 Tuskegee Airmen who were still alive. Now there are only seven alive. He's been fighting to get this movie made. He spent his own money with all the success he's had with his Star Wars films and Indiana Jones. He financed the movie himself. He went to the studios and went to them and said maybe they'll pay for print ads and whatever and the distributing of the film. They told him no. Now, he sort of turns around and says, you know, they only make green pictures. But then he owns up. Don't think that they can sell this film because it's got an all-black cast. And what George Lucas is saying is that the studios can't sell this movie because there's too many black people in it. Too many black people in it. Now, you can say whatever it is you say about the agenda of Hollywood, but the truth of the story, and we're talking about a Hollywood legend in George Lucas, who knows his business backwards and forwards, thank you, Hasbro Marketing, when 20th Century Fox said to him, yeah, we don't want any marketing on any of the toys you've got of Star Wars. So he took in all the marketing and he made a fortune because they didn't think the movie would sell. So this guy knows his business. He's no deal. And listen to what he says, James, about Tyler Perry. They won't even produce Tyler Perry's film. He's got to go to a low-budget distributor because they know how much the movie costs to make, how much it will make, and it makes the same money every time. But they don't even want Tyler Perry films.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what I'm asking. Why don't people like all black cast movies?
I have no idea.
Why doesn't Hollywood believe that America is ready for an all black cast movie? Because George Lucas, a white man, hey, look what happened.
Because liberals, no. All right, even a liberal know that even though in the face of all the evidence to the contrary, there is still the stereotype or the precedent, however you want to put it,
that if you have an all-black movie, no one's going to, only you can only sell it to black people. I mean, even liberals say that.
So you believe that Hollywood is protecting its bottom line because they believe that there's an overt racism within the moviegoer. So they're
Not even the moviegoer, because it's not the moviegoer. It's the people that you have to or you're trying to market to.
But James, hold on. We live in a country, right, that elected the first black president. George Lucas said, and I'll play it again if you need to hear it again, Hollywood said, we don't know how to market a film like this because it's got an all-black cast. Do you know what it is? Do you know what it is that they're saying? Hold on, James. Do you know what it is that they're saying? I'll tell you what they're saying. We can't sell blacks to a movie audience.
We can't sell blacks to a movie audience.
That means that they're ill-prepared to sell black actors to a movie audience. The question is, why?
I can't even begin to tell you what their thoughts are because, to me, it's outrageous. I don't see why you would not be able to sell any movie, as long as it's a good movie, regardless of the majority of what the majority of the color of people's skin are that are starring in it. What is the difference? As long as it's a good movie.
James. The Help.
Did you mention the Color Purple? You mentioned the Color Purple. I'm glad you mentioned it.
Because there's still the stereotype that black movies or a movie with a black hero or a black leading actor will not sell.
Not true.
Even in the face of the numbers, it's still not being done.
James, untrue. Let me explain to you why it is that what you just said is inaccurate. You mentioned The Color Purple. Now, when The Color Purple came out, and JC, if you can, give me the year that The Color Purple came out. And at the same time, give me the year that Schindler's List came out, if you could. I need the years that both of those movies came out. I'm almost certain The Color Purple is before Schindler's List, but I want both years. If you can look them up. And come on the air and tell me what years those were, because it's very relevant. And I know this is absolutely true. So while JC set up, cut in the middle of what I'm about to say to you. The Color Purple was nominated for 10 Academy Awards. 10. The Color Purple, when that movie came out, was not only relevant, and when I say relevant, it was not only relevant, the movie was a huge success. Everyone was talking about that movie. More white people ran to go see that movie than I can count on. Literally, I can count. When I went to the movies, I saw them with my. I went there with my aunt Sophia, and that the whole. I had to stand.
That's not what we're talking about.
Let me finish.
We're not talking about when the movie came out. We're talking about getting the movie made.
James, stop for a second. You need to hear it. There's a point to getting it. You need to hear it.
Okay?
James, The Color Purple was a Steven Spielberg film.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no award given to that film. Even Steven Spielberg couldn't figure out how Whoopi Goldberg, Oprah Winfrey, Danny Glover, how nobody got an award for that film. It was the most talked about movie when it came out. It's a huge success. But it took Spielberg to come out with Schindler's List before he won Best Director. It took Schindler's List to come out before he won Best Director. JC, please, come on. Please tell me how to find out this information. Hold on, James, real quick. JC, did you get it?
Okay, now The Color Purple came out in 1985 as a movie.
1985?
Yeah, and Schindler's List, that came out in 1993.
Look at that, my man. That's 8 years. An eight-year differential. An eight-year differential. Now, if you got any info on that, does it say how many nominations that The Color Purple got? The Color Purple was a critically acclaimed film. It was an all-black cast, and it did incredible numbers. It did incredible numbers at the box office. This was not a farce. So what George Lucas is saying, and what Steven Spielberg did in that mix, was that there's no truth. There's no truth to the fact that white America won't accept an all-black cast. It's the subject matter that really, really hurts this film. And I don't think that the producer, or pardon me, the movie houses and these movie executives, they can sell black men as heroes.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what it is that I'm saying? Because there were victims in The Color Purple. People are a slave. Whoopi Goldberg abused by her evil black husband.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Oprah Winfrey.
But only those movies seem to be critically acclaimed. Movies seem to be accepted when it falls into the accepted role of a black person.
Again,
it's already been said that, you know, with the black people who have been Oscar winners, they don't do it for roles that uplift. You're either a prostitute or a pimp or something like that.
Not true. Actually,
that's not true.
You are right. No, James, you are right about the roles.
Not
again.
True.
No, hold on. I'm going to prove it to you. Wait a minute. Now, listen to me. We have
name
to look at
the black.
James. I can name them all, James. I can name them all. That's the reason why I'm stopping you. I'm stopping you. Hold on. Hattie Mae is the most deplorable role that any black person has ever got.
I ain't burping no babies. Next.
Excuse me. She was a maid. That's one. Now.
Maid.
Let's go a little
in
Stop.
The Aunt Jemima outfit.
James.
Okay. Next.
James, I'm going to go. Okay. All right. Well, watch.
Right.
Sidney Poitier.
What did he win for?
Yeah, tell me.
Huh?
What did he play? Did he play a subservient role? Did he play a subservient role?
He won for In the Heat of the Night, correct?
No, he did not.
What did he win for?
One for playing a rant. I'm going to look that up. No, because I'm going to get this wrong. JC, please help me out. Get me 11 nominations. They were 11 nominations for The Color Purple.
I don't care about that.
Hold on. JC, get me the information on Sidney Poitier's Oscar win. I'll tell you what it is, but let's go a little further. Lou Gossett Jr., of Officer and a Gentleman. What was his role?
Officer and a Gentleman. Okay. That one? Okay.
Played drill sergeant.
Right. Okay. That one, that's one in your column.
And I'm going in order. Whoopi Goldberg.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Ghost.
One for?
Ghost. Best Supporting Actress.
Ghost, right. She's Best Supporting Actress. And she won for playing a subservient role.
No, she wasn't. She was a clairvoyant.
She played a clairvoyant, a voodoo priestess, or the daughter of a voodoo priestess.
Well, she was a scam artist.
Right, scam artist.
Okay,
same
hold
thing.
On. All right.
Okay. Not a hero.
Hold on. Next.
Not a hero. Next.
Next actor, Cuba Gooding Jr.
What?
Cuba Gooding Jr., Jerry Maguire.
A football player.
A football player who was known for either getting hurt or going out and partying and drinking.
No. He was a family man. That's not true.
No, but what was he known for in the movie?
His family man
was portrayed secondary to his character.
James.
A bad
James.
Boy football player. Somebody who has to throw
James.
A ball. Next.
James, he was a bad boy he was a bad boy football player, but he was a family man. Regina King.
But he was a family man. But he was portrayed as a bad boy first. You had to learn. You had to learn he was a family man.
Hold on, JC, were you about to say something?
Yes, Sidney Poitier became the first black person to win an Academy Award for his role in Lilies in the Field.
Lilies in the Field. I do believe it has had to do with a family of ex slaves who pull themselves up out of
I'm going to go down the list. Hold on. With Cuba Gooding Jr., he was a bad boy football player. He was a family man. And he was sort of the comic foil in that movie. But you're absolutely right. I am making a point. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm making a point. So the next role that somebody wins an Oscar nomination is whom? Who wins the next one? The next black actor to win Best Actor is Denzel Washington. He plays a corrupt cop.
Denzel Washington for a corrupt cop.
Right.
The same year,
Halle Berry wins for playing an unsavory woman who's a prostitute. Okay, it gets better. Hold on.
Yes.
Forrest Whitaker. Jamie Foxx. I apologize. Jamie Foxx is first for Ray. And then Forrest Whitaker. And then Forrest
okay.
Whitaker.
Blues singer who was on the Jim Crow network. Okay, next.
And see, I'm in Forrest Whitaker.
So all you got right now is Lou Gossett. That's it. Next.
What I'm trying to say to you is that you said that black actors don't win Academy Awards when they play drug dealers and
prostitutes. That's
true.
Really?
They play negative.
The only one that I would agree on, or anyone else can agree on, and the facts do support, is Lou Gossett Jr. Everyone else has played an unsavory character.
I'm not disagreeing with you, James. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that you said
it didn't happen. You said it did. You tried to support it.
No, what I said
it
was.
It doesn't happen, and now you're flip flopping.
No, James. What I'm saying is that you said prostitutes and pimps and gangsters. The truth is that that's not always the case because Cuba Gooding Jr. wasn't a pimp.
I've only heard one.
Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character.
Okay.
Well.
So you're going with semantics. Okay.
I'm using James. Thank you. Finally, jeez. It's turning into the fact that what I'm asking you is, and that was the whole point of this, was why is it that Hollywood can't sell a black film? What is Hollywood's problem with selling a story about black heroes? And I have the answer. I'm just wondering whether or not you can give your...
You have the answer?
If you have the answer, please give it, because in my mind, the way that I think, we are all created equal. It shouldn't matter what color you are, what religion you are, what economic background you come from. We are all equal. So I don't see why you would not, first of all, whether you can sell it or you can't, why you wouldn't want to sell it, why you wouldn't want to do something like that, why you wouldn't even want to try.
Well,
to sell
there is,
a movie
there is
about
the bottom line. There is the bottom line. Even I can accept that as a black person. I can accept that. But when people keep saying that you can't sell a black movie, and then they mention Tyler Perry, all right? Tyler Perry sells black movies, all right?
Yeah, but
there
they mentioned
black movies
Tyler
that have sold. And yet, today, even today, they still say you can't sell a movie with a black man, as a black person, as the hero, which is untrue.
Well,
but
the
it's still perceived as if you cannot. And
I'm
no
gonna...
one wants to take the chance until a Tyler Perry comes along and makes millions.
No, now, listen. Look. First of all, I can't stand Tyler Perry film, but let me say this too. The reason is that Hollywood sells stories. That's the reason why this movie Red Tails was not good by Hollywood. That doesn't support its narrow stereotypes of certain individuals. They need to maintain stereotypes because they believe the American public or the Hollywood or the moviegoer deals with stereotypes. That it is more acceptable for the moviegoer to deal with a black character in a role where he is the antagonist and not the protagonist. That the stereotypes of black people, especially black men, they must be in a position of being the anti-hero in order for them to be accepted. Look at the character Denzel Washington is playing in the new movie Safe House with Ryan Reynolds. He is a bad guy. He's the type of hero where don't know whether or not you can trust him. If you look at Training Day, he has to die at the end because he's a bad guy. He's an evil guy, but he has to foster something in you as a moviegoer that makes you hate him, but kind of like him. He's the kind of villain you like, and that's what it is—the antithesis, but the precipice of what it is that they want black characters to be in Hollywood. And they saw this movie, and they saw these black men being portrayed as heroes, to be saviors, and they said the Hollywood audience or the movie-going audience will not accept a black man in a historic way in a positive role because it goes against the narrative that the black guy is the anti-hero or the villain. And that's the bottom line. And George Lucas spoke.
But whose beliefs are these? Who really believes this? Do I live in a world all on my own? I mean, do I live in some, you know, unracist bubble? In a land by myself?
I
get
that.
Who knows this?
That's just it. The thing is, it's the perception that proves the rule. All right? Just because, I mean, the fact that there have been movies that have made millions. All right? With black people in non-derogatory or stereotypical roles, they do make money. But if you
okay,
ask
wait a minute.
One of
if you let me say this real quick, James. If you never try to put something like that out, you never know.
Right.
So
and even George Lucas said it took him how long to make this one movie?
23 years.
Even in the 23 years. All right, 23 years. And in that 23 years, there has been The Color Purple. There has been so many others, and it still took him that long to make.
So
even in the face of even when the evidence disports, all right, or disproves your perception, he still has to fight the perception.
So
it's not my perception. Let's get that straight. Not my perception.
Let's do this. Let's do this.
Right,
it's not
the movie goer. It's the movie.
James.
It's,
James. Let's do this. Let's take a break. Let's see if we can do some research on this. JC, if you can, let's see if we can find the most successful black hero or black heroic film in the history of Hollywood thus far. Let's see if we can find what movie made the most, made the biggest mark. And let's not go to Shaft or, you know, anything like that. What was?
No, I think The Wiz. I'm gonna go out on a limb, and my personal prediction, The Wiz.
The Wiz. Really? That's where you're going with this one. Okay. Well, you know what? We'll try to find out. I'll try to see whether or not we can come up with something. Let's see if we can find out what was the successful all-black film of all time. Probably going to be The Color Purple, but I don't know. I don't think Hollywood's got this wrong. I think what they're doing makes sense. I think that they're selling.
Oh my god!
It makes sense.
I think it makes sense, folks. I think it makes sense. You don't have to agree.
Let me jump in here real quick. I think it's pretty much already been proven. Has anyone seen the movie The Miracle at St. Anne?
I saw that.
Critically acclaimed.
It's Spike Lee movie.
Brilliant movie.
One of two movies by Spike Lee that I enjoyed.
A critically acclaimed, brilliant black movie.
It was. It was a brilliant black movie about World War II.
But it did absolutely nothing in the box office.
Nope.
I don't recall any. It is going up for any rewards.
But was that because of marketing? No. I mean, was there not enough marketing done? Was the marketing strategy?
Hollywood
strategy, you know, gone bad or something?
Listen to me. Hollywood knows one thing. Listen. You can make an all black movie, but you're not going to get average white people to go see a movie where the heroes or the protagonist in the film is black. They're not going to see it. They want to be people that are like themselves, and aren't enough black people in the country that are out to go see a movie with a black person hero. That's just the bottom line. It sucks, but it's just I think Hollywood's got it right. And I don't think this movie Red Tails.
I don't think Hollywood has it right at all because,
right,
all the movies that have done so and all the movies that are critically acclaimed by white people, how can you say?
And I don't mean to cut you off, guys, again, but Tyler Perry is pimping black churchgoers.
Yes.
Well, look at
yeah,
Tyler Perry.
He's pimping black churchgoers.
Look,
might as well have a huge church and send around near plates.
Look at Tyler Perry in this perspective. Look, if Tyler Perry makes a movie that costs $20 million to make and the movie puts in $60 million, whatever the distribution company is saying, look, they made three times the money it cost on the film. All of his movies make an average of $60 million. All of his films, they all do that. I think there's only been two films that have grown over $70 to $80 million. But hold on. In order to be box office success, you've got to break the $100 million mark, and none of his movies have done that. None of them have done that. And if you get a lot of out-of-work black actors that people never – Michael Jai White.
What about
give me
Precious?
A break. What?
Precious was a –
It's a Tyler Perry produced film. He didn't direct it.
He produced it.
It's directed by somebody else. Precious got critical acclaim. In fact, we go off the air when we go on break. I'm going to see. If
and she's the latest, and also the actress is the latest, I believe, the latest black actress to win an award.
As a matter of fact, it was
Monique.
Monique won. And that's right. I forgot about her. She's the last actress to win an award. But again, falls right into that character we just talked about. So I'm going to go into there's a website called boxofficemojo.com for those of you who are interested. And you can check out by logging on to that website, type in a movie that you're looking for, and you can actually find out how much money the movie made domestically and foreign. So I'm going to look it up right now, and I'm actually going to see whether or not I can get a category for black films and see if we can, you know, we can get something that will land that question when we come back. So stick around, guys. It's Reason Radio. Number is 347-308-8701. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes we don't need callers because we can just sit there and talk all day. So we'll be back. Stick around.
In Olympics hit by scandal and deficits, he rescued them. He turned around dozens of companies and became a business legend. A state losing jobs with huge deficits,
Governor Mitt Romney turned it around, cutting spending instead of raising taxes. At every step, he's met extraordinary challenges. Mitt Romney, the energy and experience to turn around Washington.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Bleu.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
And I promise you, none of these people listen to my show. But here's some people who do.
Hey, Reese.
Hey,
I don't
how
think,
you
I don't think you're a buffoon.
Thank you, dear. George, you're on with Reese.
Hi there, Reese.
Hello, George.
Please let me do the talking today.
George, you're going to be brief.
I respect what you said because you know something, you're being honest.
Hey, I'm glad that you're bringing up what's most important, and that is the issues and where people stand and what they have for experience.
It's Reese on the Radio, weekdays at 7 p.m. right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Simple question. Which candidate gives us the best chance of defeating Barack Obama? The answer? Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is a full-spectrum conservative. Rock solid on value issues like life, marriage, and the right to own a gun, Santorum is also a favorite of the Tea Party for his efforts fighting corruption and taxpayer abuse in Washington. And Rick Santorum led the fight to overhaul welfare, ending abuse and helping millions go from welfare to work. But that's just the start. Rick Santorum has more foreign policy credentials than any of the candidates. And Rick Santorum's Made in the USA jobs plan will make America an economic superpower again. Rick Santorum, a trusted conservative who not only shares our values, but also gives us the best chance to take back America. Finally, a candidate we can all unite behind. Paid for by Rick Santorum for president.
This is Rick Santorum, candidate for president, and I approve this message.
There's Dr. Oz, there's Dr. Phil, there's Dr. Drew, there's Dr. Joy Brown. It seems like everybody's got an opinion, but I'm going to leave it to the real professionals. Call up at 347-308-8701 to give me your take. It's my problem, you deal with it. Right here on Therapy Thursdays on Reese on Radio, on blogtalkradio.com, 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights on blogtalkradio.com.
Proven conservative leadership. Newt Gingrich. In uncertain times, we need a leader whose commitment to conservative values has been tested. Newt stood with Ronald Reagan. Newt stood up to Bill Clinton. And Newt was there for conservative values. But most importantly, Newt has always believed in the greatness of America, that America's best days are ahead. The choice. Newt Gingrich, the proven conservative leader. Winning our future is responsible for the content of this message.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Reese on the Radio, and you know you can get Reese on the Radio anytime you want by logging on to ReeseOnTheRadio.com. That's right. ReeseOnTheRadio.com gives you all the latest news, all the latest stories that I find interesting, and you can also click on to www.ReeseOnTheRadio.com and listen to archives of my new show, which is on BlogTalkRadio.com. That's right. It's www.reeseontheradio.com. You can get all the latest news, all the latest events, and anything else happening in Reese's world. It's Reese on the Radio, and I'm back right here on blogtalkradio.com.
He defends our freedom, and his record shows it. Ron Paul. Answering our country's call, Ron Paul became a flight surgeon in the Air Force. As a doctor, Ron Paul delivered over 4,000 babies and is a leading defender of life in Congress. Ron Paul never voted to raise taxes, never voted for an unbalanced budget, never voted to restrict gun rights or raise congressional pay. Protecting our God-given freedom. Ron Paul for president.
I'm Ron Paul, and I approve this message.
Come on, players, stop hating. Stop hating. Stop participating. Stop participating, star. Come on, twinkle, twinkle, baby. Twinkle, twinkle.
It's Reese on Radio. We're back, folks. Audio's going crazy today. But anyway, nonetheless, I don't even know what that's about. But anyway, we're back. I did some research.
Again, number is 347-308-8701. You can log on to ReeseOnTheRadio.com or check out here at blogtalkradio.com/ReeseOnTheRadio. And I did some research. I'm really skeptical about this particular source that I got it from, but let's bring the guys back in, and so that we can so have this discussion. I don't know if JC is actually. JC, did you look up anything?
Yeah, the list that I found got us completely off the mark.
It really. So the movies that you do, you have the same list that I have. The first. Oh, I'll just ask you this. Is it the 25 list?
I have the top 10.
Oh, you have the top 10. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So good, good. Let's start with 10 and work our way down. We were talking about the most successful African-American films of all time based on, I guess, how much money they grossed. And what was the list that you had? What was number 10?
Are We There Yet?
Really? What did they say the number was?
97,918,663.
Okay, so that was Are We There Yet?
Yeah, Are We There Yet? Ice Cube.
Okay, so the Ice Cube film, Are We There Yet? He did actually a series of those films. That's not bad numbers for Ice Cube. That's not bad numbers for a black film at all, and it was a comedy. So that's, you know, that's in and of itself very rare. So clearly, they can sell a movie like that because I guess it's a family movie, which is always the way to go. You know, selling a family movie. What do we got for number nine?
Number nine, we've got this one kind of really surprised me too. Marlon and Sean Wayans and Little Man.
Little Man is number nine. There's no way that would be made. I can't believe it made $7 million. Tell me what the number was on Little Man.
101,663,047.
Okay.
Wow.
So if anyone doesn't remember this movie, Little Man, it's a complete ripoff from a Bugs Bunny cartoon where a very, very small thief who looks like a baby infiltrates his home. Yeah, what was it?
He was a little gangster.
Yeah, a little gangster, but there's a Bugs Bunny episode that this is completely ripped off of. I can't believe that's on the list. Okay, so let's go to number eight.
Number eight, Ray.
Okay.
Fox.
Oh, at least we're getting to some decent and considerable films. I could.
Oh, it gets worse.
Oh,
Ray took in $125,305,995.
Okay, so that being said, so far, we've got one period drama, two comedies, so far, on the list. Let's go with number seven.
Okay. One of my favorite movies, Boomerang, 1992, Eddie Murphy.
Okay, all right, we're still in the comedy realm. So right now, as far as black films are concerned, we got 3-1, comedy versus drama. And
right.
Boomerang was a big film. I will admit that. It's one of Halle Berry's earlier films. You know, Dallas Greer, what was that, Martin Lawrence. I never really saw that film in its entirety, but a lot of people always refer to that. In the 90s, it was a big deal. All right.
It was a pretty big deal.
It was a big deal.
$131,052,444.
All right. Let's go to number six. Are we? Yeah, six now, right?
Yeah, we're going on to number six.
Number six.
Big Mama's House 2.
Oh, no! 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 No!
Big Mama's House 2 made more money than Ray did?
Yeah. Right back to comedy.
Yeah.
Again, this is proving my point. This is going to prove my point beyond a reasonable doubt, my friends. So, Big Mama's House 2, a sequel, made more money. That's crazy, and it's in the number six position. We got to go to number five, because now we're getting down to the wire. Let's go. Number five.
I hope at some point you say Malcolm X, but go ahead.
Hold on. Big Mama took in $137,047,376.
Goodness great. No wonder they keep making those movies. All right, let's go with number five.
Number five.
Another one of my favorites. 1995, Will Smith, Martin Lawrence, Bad Boys.
Okay. Action comedy.
Yeah, action comedy or
we'll
dramedy.
We'll give this, it's listed as a comedy, right? But it's an action comedy. It's a buddy film action comedy.
Yeah.
It's a buddy film action comedy. So we've only reached one drama, and we'll give half a mark on this for action, because it's an action comedy. So we'll get half a mark on that one for number five. The Bad Boys, look, folks, you know, I'm not a big fan of that whole genre, but, you know, buddy cop films are what people go to popcorn films. That's, people like popcorn films. And how much money did it make?
$141,247,413.
That's good money in Hollywood. I'll give them that. All right, number four.
Number four. This was a surprise. 2006's Dreamgirls.
All right. Well, musical, drama. Fine. Okay, fine. So I'll stick. Let's make that a drama. We'll put that in the drama category. So far, we got two to... What are we at? Two to what? Two to five or something?
Yeah, that's one where Jennifer Hudson won her award, remember?
That's right. I keep forgetting Jennifer Hudson won. Hey, Jamie, where's your argument there? Jennifer Hudson, that's right. She won Best Supporting Actress. I forgot her. So, okay. So now where are we at? Four now?
Well, yeah. That one took in $154,965,956.
All right. What number are we at now?
We're down to number three.
Okay, the number three most successful black movie of all time is?
Big Mama's House.
Oh, my God.
The first one.
Uh-huh.
So Martin Lawrence ends up on the list twice, which says a lot about Hollywood.
Three times.
Bad Boys? No, Martin Lawrence's Mama's House makes the list twice, but Martin Lawrence makes the list three times. You're absolutely right.
Right.
So he makes the list three times, but Big Mama's House makes the list twice. So Martin Lawrence, no wonder they keep banging on him. That makes a lot of sense. This would explain the farce that was The Black Knight.
And this one took in $173,559,438.
So you're saying that Big Mama's House also pulled in $200 million of box office?
Yes.
Wow. All right, let's get to number two. We're bringing it down to the wire.
The number two.
Oh, okay, now I'm scared.
2003's pulling in $272,940,870.
Wait. Before you even say, give me that number one more time.
$272 million.
It made $250 million.
Yep, 900, yeah, exactly.
Tell me the name of the movie.
Bad Boys 2.
They made a hundred million dollars more
in the sequel
than the number three.
Yes.
Yeah, they made that's incredible. So here we are, we're back in action drama. Okay, fine. So Dreamgirls and Ray is the only thing that we can say is on the drama list.
Mm-hmm.
On this whole, out of 10 of 8, I mean, out of what, 2 of 8 were drama films. So we got into what, I mean, so what are we at, number one now?
We're at number one.
Okay, so two of 9 films were drama films. Let's get to number one. And the number one most successful black movie of all time was?
Hold on, let me give you the numbers. Let's give you the numbers first. I like that. I like to give you the numbers first.
Please.
$288,800,000.
Go ahead. Who did it?
Coming to America, Eddie Murphy.
Oh, my God. I would have never thought that.
I completely forgot that. And that movie had an all-black cast.
Yeah.
That movie had an all-black cast.
In fact, it had Louis Anderson washing lettuce.
That's right, Louis Anderson. So James, you're on the line, so you heard the list. What do you think?
Wow. All right. Well, first and foremost, you can't sell a black movie, huh? Okay.
But you can't, hold on. All of those movies that we listed, and you can see the disparity there, only two on those lists could be considered dramas, and that's Dreamgirls and Ray. Everything
mm-hmm.
else was a comedy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So apparently, again, it leads to the perception that the only thing we can do is either sing or dance
or
be bad guys.
Or make people laugh.
Or suck and dive.
Yeah.
Again, so here's just Lucas bringing a movie where they're showing protagonist black men.
George Lucas, this is after he made Star Wars. He can't get a movie made.
He said it himself.
There's something coming there.
Yeah, you know what?
Yeah.
So it
does tell you something, doesn't it?
Oh, it tells me plenty of things, and I happen to agree, because those numbers prove exactly, you know, what I said. Let's play those numbers again.
Very patriotic, very jingoistic,
mm-hmm.
very old-fashioned, corny. It's just exactly like Flying Leathernecks, only this one was held up for release from 1942 when it was shot. And I've been trying to get it released ever since.
You haven't been able to get it made, you know? Well,
no.
Maybe when you get some sway in Hollywood, you'll get a chance to put something to that.
Yeah. Well, that's what people say, you know?
How long have you been working on this?
23 years. 23 years. We finished it. I financed it myself, and I figured I could, you know, get the prints and ads paid for by the studios and that they would release it. And
right.
I showed it to all of them, and they said, no. We don't know how to market a movie like this.
Why?
It's not green enough.
Really?
They only release green movies.
I didn't realize that. So the message, because the message is patriotic and jingoistic and doesn't have any recycling in it, that's the problem?
No, it's because it's an all-black movie. There's no major white roles in it at all. It's one of the first all-black action pictures ever made.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The pedigree of it? They didn't want to take a chance on
it? Yeah. It's a reasonably expensive movie.
Right.
Normally, black movies, say Tyler Perry movies or something, you know, they're very low budget, and even they won't even release his movies. You know, it goes to one of the lower,
mm-hmm.
not major distributors, and you know, and they do well, but they do a certain amount of money, and they know what that is, and this is cost more than what those movies make, so they figure well, and they don't believe there's any foreign market for it, so you know, that's 60% of their.
60% of their revenue is from the foreign markets. So the movie
can
might
just
do...
say something.
Go ahead, Jay.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
I actually, it's very insulting when you say there's no foreign market for it. I mean, you know, when you come outside of this country, right? There is the rest of the country. Not everyone is, you know, middle American white, okay? So to say that, you know, a black movie can't do well outside of this country at all, in other countries where, you know, ethnic movies and what you would call art movies, things of that nature, where a French movie that's, a silent movie. They just made a modern-day silent movie. That can do better than a black movie.
Well, if they're selling something to the foreign market and they've not had success...
The foreign market?
No. If they've not...
Black people live outside of the United States, too.
I know, but you know what? Then you know what? Those numbers, James, are very, you know, they're far... You know, it's far.
Yeah, who's writing these numbers down?
I know
you said numbers don't lie. Yeah, numbers don't lie, but the person writing the numbers down does.
Look, James, I'm telling you that George Lucas is an insider who knows this game, and this is what the Hollywood people told him. They didn't want the movie to come out, and they weren't going to support, and they didn't. But you know what? Do we want to extend this conversation, or are we going to move on to Greece?
Because
we got so much other stuff to cover.
Which was a pretty good movie in itself in 1977. But listen, I also want to note that on that list, the list that I read off over the top,
10 highest paid grossing black films of all time. Eddie Murphy was on it 3 times.
That's right. Eddie Murphy's on it 3 times, just like Martin Lawrence. Well, that means that they accept comedy better than they like action films. It's Reese on the Radio. We'll be back. Goodbye.
With being an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times.
Do you want to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times?
Yeah, I think I'd like to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times.
Then grab it! Grab it!
Mary had a little lamb, it creeped white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Yeah, I'm super cool.
I never once said, Nagada.
I think everyone wants to know where we came from and how the universe began.
You know what I'm saying?
I have sinned against you.
It's Reese on the Rio. Number 347-308-8701. Email us at reeseontherio@yahoo.com. And we have plenty of things that we had to talk about in Murphy Thursday. But, you know, sometimes the conversation just drags on. And for good reason, because, you know, sometimes the topics, they take a life of their own, especially when they're irrelevant. And we cover the news as it happens. We cover the story as they happen. And, again, it's just news and views. And what I love about this show, and I love about my panel, JC, James, Mary, why are you bugging? But they all have opinion, and that's what it is that we do. We give an opinion. And I think that you share some of the opinion that we have. I think a lot of people, you know, can agree with some of the stuff that we say. I don't think they agree with James, but, you know, whatever. Nothing against him. I'm just kidding. This story that I saw on Drudge Report was baffling to me for a host of reasons, because it has to deal with what I believe is the state of our union as a country, even as a world, this entitlement society. And Greece is going through it in such a way that it needs to be addressed, because it will eventually affect the world market and citizens of the world, as Barack Obama likes to say. You know, what happens in our world will affect us. You know, sometimes we distance ourselves from those things and they say, you know, it's not my problem, it's not my beef, it's not my issue. But what's happening in Greece is very, very obvious, because of the way that they run their country, a socialist country. And that's, you know, socialism is a bad word. I don't care what anybody says, it's a bad word. And it affects the market in the societies. What's happening today in Greece has gotten to the point where parents cannot afford to take care of their own children. And when you hear that, you go, well, you know, everybody's struggling taking care of their own children. But imagine this scenario where you're so hard that you dump your children into streets. And you bring your children off, you know, these places to take care of them. Orphanages, children's centers. One woman, as I said in the beginning of the show, woman went so far as to leave her kid sitting at the front door of one of these establishments
And she left a note with her daughter that simply she couldn't take care of her child anymore. She said that I can't afford to feed my child. I'm sorry, but it's just too tough. Now, that to me bothers me on so many other levels because you just, you know, this is your child. I want what's best. And what parent doesn't want what's best for their kids? And they've gotten to the point where they don't want their children to suffer in some way that they would leave their kid with strangers just to, I don't know, just to make things easier on themselves. I'm pulling up the report now because I want to read you the quote that the mother wrote on the letter. Now, the story says that parents are dumping their kids on the street. There's no report of these actual kids being dumped. If you look at the picture, when you go to blogtalkradio.com/recentradio, the picture that I put on this story is this little boy banging on a little drum, and his clothes are sitting in front of him. He's just out there standing in the street. Now, I don't know whether or not this particular child was abandoned, but it paints quite a picture. And I think the picture is there to paint that exact sort of narrative. This child with no shirt on, you know, banging on a drum, probably fending for himself, trying to make some sort of money to feed himself. Look at stories that narrow in Brazil. The story by younger, I mean, to part of street gang, if you know, rock. I apologize again for the feed. Again, we're back to deal with this constant chopping, breaking back up. As I was saying before the interruption, what in the world there?
In Olympics hit by scandal and deficits, he rescued them. He turned around dozens of companies and became a business legend. A state losing jobs with huge deficits, Governor Mitt Romney turned it around, cutting spending instead of raising taxes. At every step, he's met extraordinary challenges. Mitt Romney, the energy and experience to turn
testing,
around...
Testing, testing, one, two.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Dan Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Bleu.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
And I promise you, none of these people listen to my show. But here's some people who do.
Hey, Reese.
Hey,
how
you doing?
I don't think you're a buffoon.
Thank you, dear. George, you're Robert Reese.
Hi there, Reese.
Hello, George.
Please let me do the talking today.
George, you're going to be brief.
I respect what you said because you know something, you're being honest.
I'm glad that you're bringing up what's most important, and that is the issues and where people stand and what they have for experience.
It's Reese on the Radio, weekdays at 7 p.m. right here on blogtalkradio.com. Simple question. Which candidate gives us the best chance of defeating Barack Obama? The answer, Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is a full-spectrum conservative, rock solid on value issues like life, marriage, and the right to own a gun. In Olympics.
Again, folks, we apologize. Again, it is the same problem that we had yesterday.
Hey, Mary?
Yeah.
Okay, apparently we kind of lost our host, so he'll be back in a moment for those of you out there that are listening. Exactly, where did he leave off?
Well, he was talking about what was going on in Greece, that they're in such, in you know, such dire straits right now because of the euro, because they've been borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, really is what it boils down to, and they're a socialist country, that these parents or these women, these mothers, are dropping their children off at doorsteps of other people's homes or daycare centers, for lack of better words, for lack of a better term, and leaving. This one woman even went to, they quote her letter in the report that we read on DrudgeReport.com, that she was leaving her child because she simply could not afford to feed her child any longer. And she obviously knew that these people would be able to give her child a better life. So they're just in such an economic downturn that it's so bad that they say that they're dropping hundreds of kids off just for other people to take care of, because these people simply can't afford to take care of their own children anymore.
Thank you for that. You guys can hear me now? Am I back?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I apologize again. It's a constant issue, and I'm going to do my best to make sure I do this. BlogTalkRadio.com is a great company, and there's nothing wrong with them, but we're having some issues. It's the same exact time that we had last night, and it's doing it again, and I've got to find a way to make sure that this is remedied. But again, Mary, you succinctly expressed that I don't understand what it is that would make a parent abandon their child. I understand the best for your kid. You know, I know I don't have any kids. JC, you do, so I have to ask you. If you've gone on a hard economic time like the rest of us, could you do this?
No. You got a snowball's chance of letting me ever abandon my kids. I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding this at all. And I think I kind of feel the same way I did when, I don't mean to fly off subject, but when they had the earthquake in Haiti.
Right.
And we were sending lots of food down there, and the world was coming together to send food down there. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm on an island surrounded by water, surrounded by fish. There ain't no way in hell my family's going to starve.
Isn't that amazing, though, that the people in Haiti, after that earthquake, aside from the fact they were already in deplorable conditions, but they didn't have the wherewithal, Haitians, to find ways to fish. It's the Caribbean, the best possible way to put it.
Some of the best tuna on the planet comes from the Caribbean.
Pardon? I'm sorry?
I said some of the best tuna on the planet comes from the Caribbean.
Right, exactly. I mean, there is a way to feed yourself out there in some sort of way, even if you have to go out there and become a fisherman. But I think the government in Haiti plays a huge part. This is, it does in Greece. I think that Greece's policies as a government has really, really helped, or hurt, I should say, has really hurt the situation in that country. And when you have so many people on the dole, and so many people out of work, and so many people who can't find ways to feed themselves, to take care of themselves, and they are dependent on the dole. When a country runs out of money, you cannot feed the people that you're paying for. When there are more people on the dole than there are who are working, eventually you run out of money.
Okay, let me jump in here real quick. So this. Reese and I talked about this last night. It was on DrudgeReport.com, is where the story was read from. So, but the night prior to this, I actually read an article, and I can't recollect where I found the article at, but it was on a, I don't know if it was the New York Times or it was some news some news internet. So I read an article that was, and it's been all over the radio, if anybody listens to the news, that, you know, the euro is in big trouble right now. This could really affect our country as well. It could, you know, affect the entire world. What I read in the story the night before was just simply about the fact that, you know, they were trying to get private people to come in and take some of this debt on, but there were going to be repercussions of taking the debt on if that's what happened, and that Germany and I think France had backed out of taking on any of this debt that Greece has, if I stand correctly. And I want to look a little bit more into it, but nothing in that report ever said anything to the nature that they were in such dire straits that people were dropping hundreds of kids off at a time, or hundreds of kids off because they couldn't feed their children. So I just, for me personally, I find it a little odd that I'm reading this one story one day, and then the next day we go from almost one extreme to the next. Now we're in such dire straits that we're dropping hundreds of kids off because parents just simply can't afford to feed them anymore. And I'm going to research that, and maybe, you know, we'll talk about it again on another show after I'm able to research and see how we went from one extreme to the next.
Well, that being said, do you think it's a cultural thing? Because I'm looking at this from a cultural level. And it's why I look at it that way, because I know who we are as Americans. And I believe that the American public, we have a certain set of rules. There's an unwritten rule about family in the United States. I don't think that the American public in dire situations would ever do the things that are being reported happening in Greece. I don't think that American people would ever drop off their kids at orphanages at this magnitude. I think the story said hundreds of parents. Like, it could be 50 kids, you know, but it could be 100 kids. But that's an alarming amount of children being dropped off. That when I said in the report, you know, these people are dropping the kids because they trust us, they know we'll take care of them. But I couldn't imagine the American people, or any American for that matter, or anybody in Western civilization, that would ever do this, even in dire situations. And I'm baffled by this almost seems primitive.
It does seem primitive, but in a way, I mean, okay, I don't have any children, but in a way, if I had children and I had no other means, there was no other way but for me to give my child up for me to not be selfish and give my child up to someone else that could take care of them and they would not starve to death, which it's so mind-boggling to me that they're in such dire straits that their children are starving to death to the point where they have to drop them off in strangers' houses or any type of, you know, community centers or whatever that are there. That's mind-boggling to me. I don't understand that. I really don't. I don't understand how you get to that point. But if you are to that point, I find it very unselfish of the parents to do that.
So, okay, so you think in some regard they're doing the right thing?
If it is to that point, I think that in some regards they're doing the right thing. However, is it really to that point? And if it is, something's got to be done for the children's sake, if not for anyone else's sake. And what happened to your neighbors helping you? What happened to, do these people not have aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters? I mean, is everybody in the family in dire straits and every single family? Is there not anybody out there that can help them if it's to that point?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Reese.
No. I'm saying you're absolutely, I agree with Larry. Go ahead.
But it's kind of almost like they become so dependent on the government. I'm not sure how it is in Greece, whether they're one of those nations where, and not necessarily communist, but
they are socialists. They are socialists. And,
okay.
and you're the point you're making is right. Are they so reliant on the government that when the government can no longer take care of them, that they shirk all responsibility?
And they shut down.
They can't figure out anything for themselves. They can't make decisions on their own, can't financially support themselves because the government can't help them, and they can't make. And again, this is what I talk about when I say government intervention. When government becomes so large that it controls every facet of your life, that when government can no longer provide, you lost the wherewithal to make ends meet or make means on your own. And I think this is a good example of that by dumping their children off in the way that they are. Does that make sense?
First of all, if that is the situation, that is absolutely crazy. There is no way on a cold day in the H word that I am going to allow myself to be so dependent on a government where I couldn't even take care of my children.
But I think that's the state of the world that we're living in. You know, I mean, that's their world today. I don't think they're ever going to be able to sustain taking care of themselves because they become so reliant on the government for so long. I think there is sort of a tone that's set within that country that this is the way that things were, and when the hammer drops, when the last shoe falls, and this situation happens, people throw up their hands and they go, well, what am I supposed to do?
Well, did these people not see this coming? I mean, it's not like this is something new. It's not like just all of a sudden 2 days ago there was a report that the government has no more money and we can't afford to help you people anymore. I mean, there something led up to this. So uneducated people? Are they, you know, what I would be interested to seeing, you know, what kind of people are doing this?
These are people that are born into this. They're born and programmed and to believe in that, you know, the government's going to always be there to help them and take care of them. And they live their lives doing what it is that the government requires of them.
Shame on their parents and shame on anybody else.
No, their parents have gone through it too.
Shame on their parents.
You know, Mary and I use this one term, and when I heard Mary use it, I was surprised because I thought I was the only person who used this term. But there may be a social norm in Greece that is reliant on its government, and this has become such a commonplace for them that with government, and this is why there have been riots in Greece. You've heard the reports over the last couple of years. The people are in the streets rioting that the government is not providing with the services that they used to, that the government is pulling back, and they're doubling down on, look, we can't afford this anymore. And the people are going, what are you talking about? They're right. No, we're going. You ain't taking care of us anymore. And they're all out in the streets and they're throwing Molotov cocktails and rocks and stuff at the police. They're rioting in the streets because now the government's saying, "Look, I know what you're used to. We can't get anymore. It can't sustain itself."
Okay, and well, just because you live in a society where your government is willing and at one point was able to give you what you needed to get by, I can't see that they were giving them, that they were giving people any more than the bare necessity to get by. When is that okay to just be okay with that? I mean, don't you want to prosper? Don't you want to be able to buy your own home? Don't you want to be able to do better than just the bare minimum? So
Not when they simply don't know any better. No, see, Mary,
that's the point you're missing. That's what socialism breeds. See, socialism, and forget about the financial part. We're talking about what the zeitgeist is in socialist communities. The zeitgeist is this, and it's very, very simple. In a socialist society, you maybe don't have any more than what I have. We all have the same thing. There is no temperature where we tell, like, the temperament is not prosperity. Temperament is not you do well and you become successful or you become wealthy. That's not the temperament. The temperament in socialist countries is everybody has the same. Everybody makes the same amount of money. Everybody has a certain set of things. They're all under this one sort of guideline that they live by. No one has better. In a socialist society, that's what socialism is that no one has more than the other.
But if no one, but hold on one second. I understand your point, but if no one has any more than the other, who are these people dropping their kids off with? Because obviously those people have something more than they did.
Exactly. But you know what? These are programs that get an allotment of money, right? And if I'll put it to you like this. This is the best way to put it. If you have what's considered a tone in the country, with the rich getting rich, poor keeping poor, why can't we all share the money? And what Greece has done is we're all going to make the same amount. No one makes more money. No one advances. No one gets anything better than any person, because what that breeds is jealousy. Oh, he's got better car than me. Oh, he's got better clothing than me. Oh, he's got a better job than me. That breeds some sort of jealousy. So we've eliminate that. We eliminate all of that. We have everybody have the same thing. In order for them to have it, we're going to make sure that we as a government provide that.
But how is
sort of,
the,
that
if,
sort of lifestyle?
Okay, so if that
if
is the case,
employed,
how is the government
how
is the government making money to support their socialist society?
Because remember, if you now let's take 100 people, let's use a small number. I'll use a small number here. Let's take 100 people. If we have 100 people in a country, and only 5 of those people are billionaires, and our tax law says you're a billionaire, so we're going to tax you at 60%, or we're going to tax you 50%. And the rest of the country, the 95 people, right, the 95 people left in the country, they're going to have meal jobs where they all make a set amount of money, that they get government programs and everything to maintain their lives, because there's nothing in that country that allows you to advance. You can't make more money than anybody else. You can't do anything better than anybody else. There's nothing that even promotes capitalism.
I can't even fathom the thought
of
living in a country.
And we're always going to rely on those 5 people.
I can't even fathom the thought of living that type of life. There would be
it's
no way.
It's frowned upon, Ari, if you make what. Remember, we live in a country today. The argument is that the rich people are the bad people. That being rich, you're evil. If you made money in this country, this is the topic of discussion today with the election. Is that constant reminder that if you're rich in this country, you made it off the backs of the poor. So the poor people, that's what Occupy Wall Street is all about, is that the rich got all the money, and we've got nothing. And we're not making any money. We want them to share. We want them to get more. We want them to pay their fair share. And I say, you know, when they say the fair share, is the definition of fair share is you work a certain amount of time, I work a certain amount of time, and we all pay fair share. But what Occupy Wall Street and people like that are saying is that we've got nothing. You've got it all. Give everything. So we can have more,
right,
too.
Share the wealth.
Yes, share your
wealth. Now, is it really about that, or is it about the fact? Okay, this is how I view things work here in America, or in my world.
Okay, I'm glad to clear that up.
Or in my world, in my America. Now, if you dedicate yourself to working hard and trying to do the best that you can to make better for yourself and your family, if you have one, and those around you, you should not be stepped on, and you should not...
You should be punished.
You should not be punished for that, but here's where the problem lies. When you have people, you have all these people in this country that have, you know, that are millionaires or billionaires, your average person, your average Joe, someone like me, someone like you, it's very hard if you don't know somebody. It's not about what you know anymore. It's about who you know. It's about 7 degrees. Is it 6 degrees of separation or 7 degrees?
6 degrees. 6 degrees.
6 degrees of separation. Thank you. And it seems like that is a trend that, you know, if you know somebody, you can get a better paying job. If you are sleeping with someone that's in a good position, you can get a better paying job. You don't have to. A lot of people that have money didn't really have to bust their humps to get to that because they came from that.
You believe that? Do you believe that? 67% of the wealthy in this country, 67% of the wealthiest people in this country started from nothing. They were all entrepreneurs. It's a large amount of people who started from scratch. You know, they created their business. I mean, you're going to look at Steve Jobs or Bill Gates as people who made their money off the backs of others. These people invented something that people bought, you know, and got services. They provided goods and services for. And, you know, there are people that whole thing about companies aren't people or corporations aren't people. Sure they are, because they started by a person's idea. But when you have a society like Greece who has taught their citizens that the rich in this country got it by some sort of ill-gotten gains, it creates that temper where people start to believe, oh, those people made it by ill-gotten gains and they did it in a nefarious way, a disingenuous way. And I don't believe that to be true. This is what class warfare has done to this country of late. I think it's always been a play in socialist countries like England, like France, of course, like Greece.
Well, I can't say that everybody in this country has, you know, gotten where they are because they've, you know, done something bad to somebody or they've done someone wrong. But it is common that people do step on other people, no matter, like cockroaches, no matter what, regardless of, you know, whether they can sleep at night or they can't, to get to where they have to be. And it is common that there are a lot of privileged people out there that are only privileged because of the amount of money that they have or the fame that they have, which comes with money.
Well, that's kind of what makes this country great.
That is common in this country. And
yeah, but
it's not a good thing. You should get to where you want to be because
you know, Barry, suggesting that the people who are wealthy in this country did not work hard. I said that would be a suggestion that the people in this country who have did work hard. And I don't believe that to be true. I believe that the people in this country who are wealthy, and as I said, 64% of our country are entrepreneurs, and they've made their money by working hard and creating a product and providing goods and services. I believe that. And they deserve the wealth that they have. And I think that it should inspire us to do the same. I'm not saying that we all can be entrepreneurs, but we all got to better ourselves. I don't think that's being taught in places like Greece.
Right. Liberty old Robin Hood, Queen old Robin, ready to give it to the poor.
I don't think that you should take people's hard-earned money and, you know, give it to the poor just because they're poor. You know, I mean, this country there's opportunities here. If you have to work at McDonald's and flip hamburgers, if I lost my income today, if you think that I would not go and flip hamburgers at a McDonald's to make ends meet, you got something else coming, because I would do it. I don't care what kind of job. I don't care if I'm working in a big corporation. It doesn't matter. If I don't have that job anymore, I'm going to go do what I have to do to at least try to make ends meet.
Right. McDonald's really today isn't a bad job.
No, I'm not saying it is a bad job, but...
Everybody's been using McDonald's for years.
Well, just because it's a fast food restaurant, not because it's McDonald's. I have nothing against McDonald's. I'm not saying that.
Oh, okay.
And just because the rate of pay would not be anywhere equivalent to the current rate of pay. So, you know, for my current rate of pay, I should say. So I'm just using that, you know, if I had to take a lesser paying job, then I would do that. I'm not going to sit at home on unemployment or sit at home on welfare waiting for somebody else to give me something when I can be out there occupying my time and putting, you know, and trying to do something better for myself.
My sister, rather than occupy Wall Street, they need to occupy them damn selves. For real. Get up, get out, and go do something.
I just can't fathom. I guess I can't wrap my head around, you know, I guess how lucky I am to be in this country, because
okay.
I would never.
Reese, we're losing you completely.
Really bad, Reese.
Yeah, we can't. We're not getting you at all. No, we're still here, people, guys. We're still here. We have a technical issue with the microphone. Could be with time. Not sure. We're not sure. Anyways, number 347-308-8701. This is Reese on the radio.
Okay, I don't know if you can hear me, but...
there we go.
Yeah, every time he comes in, he goes back out.
Yeah, you want to? Yeah, he got booted out. I'm going to continue on.
So, like I was saying, I just can't. I can't even imagine that people live that way. It is so unimaginable for me.
And became a business legend. A state losing jobs with huge deficits. Governor Mitt Romney turned it around, cutting spending instead of raising taxes. At every step, he's met extraordinary challenges. Mitt Romney, the energy and experience to turn around Washington.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Hey, guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Dude Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Bleu.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
And I promise you, none of these people listen to my show. But here's some people who do.
Hey, Reese. I don't think you're a buffoon.
Thank you, dear. George, you're on with Reese.
Hi there, Reese.
Hello, George.
Please let me do the talking today.
George, you're going to be brief.
I respect what you said, because you know something, you're being honest.
Hey, Reese, I'm glad that you're bringing up what's most important, and that is the issues and where people stand and what they have for experience.
It's Reese on the Radio, weekdays at 7 p.m. right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Simple question. Which candidate gives us the best chance of defeating Barack Obama? The answer? Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum is a full-spectrum conservative. Rock solid on value issues like life, marriage, and the right to own a gun, Santorum is also a favorite of the Tea Party for his efforts fighting corruption and taxpayer abuse in Washington. And Rick Santorum led the fight to overhaul welfare, ending abuse and helping millions go from welfare to work. But that's just the start. Rick Santorum has more foreign policy credentials than any of the candidates. And Rick Santorum's Made in the USA jobs plan will make America an economic superpower again. Rick Santorum, a trusted conservative who not only shares our values, but also gives us the best chance to take back America. Finally, a candidate we can all unite behind. Paid for by Rick Santorum for President.
This is Rick Santorum, candidate for president, and I approve this message.
There's Dr. Oz. There's Dr. Phil. There's Dr. Drew. There's Dr. Joy Brown. It seems like everybody's got an opinion. But I'm going to leave it to the real professionals. Call up at 347-308-8701 to give me your take. It's my problem. You deal with it. Right here on Therapy Thursdays on ReSun Radio on blogtalkradio.com, 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights on blogtalkradio.com.
Proven conservative leadership. Newt Gingrich. In uncertain times, we need a leader whose commitment to conservative values has been tested. Newt stood with Ronald Reagan. Newt stood up to Bill Clinton. And Newt was there for conservative values. But most importantly, Newt has always believed in the greatness of America, that America's best days are ahead. The choice. Newt Gingrich, the proven conservative leader. Winning our future is responsible for the content of this message.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Reese on the Radio, and you know you can get Reese on the Radio anytime you want by logging on to ReeseOnTheRadio.com. That's right. ReeseOnTheRadio.com gives you all the latest news, all the latest stories that I find interesting, and you can also click on to www.ReeseOnTheRadio.com and listen to archives of my new show, which is on BlogTalkRadio.com. That's right. It's www.reeseontheradio.com. You can get all the latest news, all the latest events, and anything else happening in Reese's world. It's Reese on the Radio, and I'm back right here on blogtalkradio.com.
He defends our freedom, and his record shows it. Ron Paul. Answering our country's call, Ron Paul became a flight surgeon in the Air Force. As a doctor, Ron Paul delivered over 4,000 babies and is a leading defender of life in Congress. Ron Paul never voted to raise taxes, never voted for an unbalanced budget, never voted to restrict gun rights or raise congressional pay. Protecting our God-given freedom, Ron Paul for president.
I'm Ron Paul, and I approve this message.
Come on, players, stop hating. Stop hating. Stop participating. Stop participating, star. Come on, twinkle, twinkle, baby. Twinkle, twinkle.
All right, guys, it's Reese on the Radio. I hope that people can hear me just a little bit better. Let's find out. We've been having some technical difficulties all day. Have I gotten any better, guys?
A lot better.
Much better.
Oh, my God, it's
a lot
better.
Better.
Yes.
100%
oh.
Better.
Oh, well, okay. I was just worried about that because I couldn't hear anything. I can hear everybody now. Okay, so, of course, it's Therapy Thursday, folks, on Reese on the Radio. And this one is not really like some personal story. It's not, you know, it's not something that you get some sort of insight in my personal life.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling, tossed salads and scrambled eggs. Mercy. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled egg all over my face. What?
So here's the deal, folks. So this afternoon, I'm listening to talk radio, and I'm listening to one of my favorite, well, my most favorite talk show host. I won't even mention their name now, but I'm listening, and they reported a story that I ended up going on to Yahoo, and the story was there, and I have to admit, nothing is worse for me, Mary, than getting duped. I don't like it when I'm fooled about something. Nothing makes me more upset when I'm fooled, when I'm made to believe something that isn't true. And as many of my friends and colleagues know, I am a proponent of red wine. I love red wine. I drink it all the time. My favorite is Pinot Noir. I'll drink a Merlot or a Cabernet Sauvignon here and there, but I love Pinot Noir. Love red wine. And when I became a fan of it before the report came out, but the report came out later and said, hey, do you know that red wine is a great cardiovascular drink you know, helps you live longer. It does great things for your body, for your skin, whatever. And I was like, yeah, you know, look, I was ahead of the game on that one. I jumped right on. I said, I knew I write like red wine for a reason. I felt good about that. But then I found something out that completely just broke my heart. It turns out that the guy who did the study was lying. And he is now charged with 145 counts of fraud. It turns out red wine does nothing for your heart. It does nothing. And so my personal dilemma is that,
what do I drink now?
What do I do now? I always loved red wine. I enjoyed it.
Take a brisk walk. That's what you do now.
I'm not taking a brisk walk. It's not happening. I take a brisk walk to the store to go get wine.
Yeah.
Listen. Put on your big boy drawers.
Put on
your big boy drawers.
Put on my big boy drawers. Look, I got duped. I feel like I got lied to. I feel like somebody cheated me. I feel like somebody deceived me. I feel cheated. I feel slighted. I want vengeance.
You want vengeance?
Yes, I want vengeance.
Who is the person that made the report? Because I've heard this on several different shows.
Well, look, it's funny because everybody was talking about it today because this was something that everybody was lauding. Everybody was saying that this was, you know, this was the next big thing. You know, you drink red wine and live longer. It does great cardiovascular health. And I was believing the hype. I was like, see, I knew it. I was on the red wine way before. And I knew it was good. See, what do you know? And I got all these people throwing other wines at me. You don't like Pinot Grigio? Nah, I don't drink white wine. You don't like white Zinfandel? Nah, I don't drink white Zinfandel. That's for homeless people and sluts. I don't drink.
What happened to MD 2020?
I don't drink no hard liquor either, unless it's Bacardi. But I'm only messing around with red wine because that's what somebody of my stature should drink. Because I got style and grace.
Wow. Again,
and
your big
and what you
draws.
Thought was a healthy heart.
That's right. But look at my healthy heart. I'm drinking red wine. I'm part of the elite. I put up my glass of red wine. And when I go to the restaurant, let me tell you what happens when I go to the restaurant. Every time I go to the restaurant, I'll be with a group of people. And the waitress will come by, or the waiter, whatever. And they come by, and you know, they're asking everybody for their drink menu. And I'll be looking at the wine list. And I look at the wine list and I go, can you tell me something about this Bordeaux? You know, can you, how about this Pinot Noir? Is this okay? And they go,
yeah.
Well, this one's all right, this one's this. And then they'll do this. And they do it every time. They go, I can bring you a sample. You can try a little bit. I'll bring a couple up. So while everybody else is already figuring out their drink menu, I'll be the snob with three glasses sitting in front of me and with little sips in it. And I'll take a sip and I'm washing around in my mouth. Take some water, take the next glass. And I'm sitting there going, I like this one. This one's a little woody. I don't like that one. It's too much berry. I like more wood. I like a little wood flavor. It's kind of like, your heart's very dry. I like that. And everybody says the same thing. It's like, dude, man, come on, just wine. And I'm going, no, there's a certain kind of wine. I don't care if it's got to be from Oregon. It's got to have an odd number in the year. I'm dead serious, Mary. I'm not kidding. If you send me a bottle of wine with an even
hint,
number
hint.
Year, what's that?
I said hint, hint.
If you send me a bottle of wine with an even number, I will break that bottle and try to cut you. But don't ever send me a bottle with an even number.
Mary?
You send me a bottle of wine, it better be an odd number, and it better be more than 4 years old.
Mary, I've been in a strip club with this guy.
Oh,
yeah,
my God.
Tell him,
and we're all drinking beer out of bottles.
Right.
And he's sitting there with the damn wine glass. The only one in the club with a wine glass.
That's because he's not stupid. He knows that the ladies are not paying attention to the guys drinking beer bottles. They're paying attention to the little. They're paying attention to the skinny, tall, snobby guy.
Sipping on the red wine.
Mary, you have to understand. Plant. We're in a strip club with thousands stacked up in the middle of the table, and he's off to the side with his funny little. I don't know what kind of cigarette he was smoking. With the weird old lady pack and his damn glass of wine.
And he stood out in that crowd like a sore thumb.
That's right, with my pinky up.
With his pinky up.
With my pinky up. And I'm looking at the stripper, and she's dancing around, and she's coming over asking for a lap dance. You know, I'm asking her, you know, where she went to school. You're a fine specimen.
This is true.
Where did you learn those acrobatics at?
Exactly. You look very, very limber. What are you drinking over there, wine? And I always tell them, especially when they say, what are you drinking, wine? Wine? I'm drinking Pinot Noir. It's one of the best wines there is. I'm a snob. But
I want to know what strip clubs are you going to find the best red wine? That's what I want to know.
Well, actually, now see, you're absolutely right, Mary. A strip club and fine wine is an oxymoron in and of itself. The two shall never meet in the
sense.
It shouldn't, but it met in your hands and down your gully. And Mary, and then he takes the wine, sets it in the other hand, and reaches that decrepit long E.T. looking pinky up in the air and reaches in and grab a hot wing.
And grab a hot wing. And grab a hot wing. I'm not going to lie. Look, chicken and red wine don't mix, but, you know, they only serve hot wings at these places.
but they serve fine red wine to go with those hot wings.
What they didn't tell you, Reese? Yeah, no. I lived not too far from that place, so I'm a regular there.
What's the name of the club? What's the name of the strip club we went to? Cahoots.
We're at Cahoots.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's funny because I used to stop there during the day because they make one hell of a filet mignon sandwich.
Let me tell you something.
They do.
You were at the strip club at Cahoots in Connecticut, and they were all in Cahoots. They saw you coming, and you were drinking strawberry Boone Hill strawberry wine. That's what you were drinking. Boone's Farm.
Strawberry wine. Strawberry. Well, come on. Give me a break. The point of this is that nobody pulls a fast one on Reese on the radio. Nobody does it. And this guy did, and he made me believe that I was drinking this wine and I had a healthier heart behind it, and it turns out there was nothing for me. Nothing.
And you know, it's funny, you know what? When you hear the reports and when they talk about red wine, it says, hell, they even give it to the kids over in France. Yeah, they want the kids to grow up healthy.
Now, here's the question. Here's my question for you, Reese. This is what I propose to you. Is this falsification of red wine being healthy for your heart going to restrict you to drinking something else? Are you going to stop drinking red wine because it's not healthy for your heart?
This is my dilemma, and we've only got about 6 minutes, so that's why Therapy Thursday is so relevant, okay? I'm asking, okay, look, I love red wine. I enjoy red wine. I feel good when I drink it. When I say feel good, I mean aesthetically. I feel like, you know, I feel like the man. I feel debonair. You know, like when James Bond had his, you know, his martini shaken, not stirred. You know, I go into the establishment and you're Pinot Noir. What's that, 2007? Where are the grapes?
the grapes of Breadware in Oregon. Okay, let me try a sip of that and some of the California. Can you bring the California and I'll take a sip? I was like, okay, give me a bottle of that. How much is that? $50? Not a problem. Bring that over here. No problem. Keep them coming. If we finish this bottle, we bring another. Please, thank you. Thank you very much.
Are you really saying that you are debonair drinking a bottle of $50 wine? Are we serious?
I am a debonair son of a gun in the road. JC, will you tell her? I go in there with such a snout. I'm in there
Reese, I know you. He doesn't have to tell me. And I can picture you. I see it all over your face. I see the body language. I know.
Yeah.
Believe me, I know. But are you sitting here telling me that you are being debonair drinking a bottle of $50 wine?
If that's all they've gotten in the cellar, that's all they've gotten in the cellar.
That's what they have in the cellar. But you know what? The average bottle of wine is $11. If I'm buying a $50 bottle of wine, it better be what it is that I asked for. And now I don't know what to do. What am I going to be stuck drinking? I'm never going to drink it.
Why would you stop drinking red wine just because it doesn't have the added-on bonus to make your heart healthy? Why don't you eat a bowl of oatmeal and then later on drink some red wine?
It's going to taste different. It's going to feel different.
Yeah, oatmeal. What am I, seven?
Hey, it's
listen, buddy, get you a bottle of Barefoot Moscato and call it a day.
Barefoot? Who drinks that wine?
Get yourself a cold bottle of Rolling Rock, and you'll be good to go.
I'm not drinking Rolling Rock, and I tried that. That stuff is,
I love Rolling Rock. That is my favorite beer.
It tastes like watered-down booze. It's awful. I don't drink that stuff. I've got a certain reputation.
Well, go get a 40 OE and a paper bag and call it a day.
Listen to me. They don't understand what they've done to my image. This is actually taking an attack at my image. My image. Now when I'm drinking red wine in public, you know what they're going to say to me every time they see me drinking red wine? You know that does nothing for your heart. You know the report. They're going to keep remember. They're going to be telling me the report like I wrote it.
You know? Did you hear about that survey?
You're the only one that is going to be. That little person is going to be on your shoulder, yelling into your ear. You know that's nothing good for your heart. You know drinking that is not good for your heart. You have no more
excuses. Wine isn't all it's cracked up to be. There, you spiffy little son of a gun. You thought you was a big man on campus. Drinking wine. Looking all prim and proper. It wasn't the same thing, huh? It ain't the same thing no more. Wine is just like regular old beer. That's exactly what's going to happen. That's what somebody's going to say to me. I'm going to order a glass of wine, and that's all they're going to be writing me. Hey, did you hear that report? Turns out the guy lied about red wine. You know what I'll be saying the whole time? Shut your damn mouth. Shut up. Okay.
No one else has read that report, Reese. No one else is going to be able to tell.
Well, you know what? Listen to me. If I hear somebody, when I order red wine, the next time that I go to a restaurant and order red wine, and somebody mentions that to me, I promise you I'm going to bring that report right here. I'm going to record this son of a gun who said it, and I'm going to play the audio right here on the show.
You do that. I'll be here waiting for that report.
Telling you.
I know how you feel. You know what wine I grew up on?
So now you can no longer be a dashing, debonair young man. Because you can't get red wine. Because red wine is not healthy for your heart.
No, it's not healthy for my heart. Anyway, it's time for us to go. It's Reese on the Radio. We'll be back tomorrow. It'll be Friday.
We've got to talk about Harvey's Bristol Cream.
Yeah, Harvey's Bristol Cream. Hey, we're going to talk about the Marines urinating on Taliban insurgents, dead Taliban insurgents tomorrow. So stick around. I think that these guys should be commended.
Oh, my God.
I'll be commended. It's Reese on the Radio. See you tomorrow.